You know the saying, hell hath no fury. Like a what? Woman scorned. You obviously don't know the saying because you don't practice the meaning by it. Meaning, you don't mess with a woman. Okay? Because we love with our whole hearts.
Yeah.
And when we do, and when you crush it, look, some of us are able to walk away, but some of us feel like we need to get some revenge before we walk away.
It's business time, baby.
The Solomonster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 486 of the Solomonster Sounds Off here for Sunday, March 12th, 2017. I am the Solomonster. 3 weeks until our meetup in Orlando. Tin Roof is the place to be. WrestleMania Sunday, April 2nd, 11:15 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. You could check out the Facebook invite for all the information. You could RSVP there as well. Bring your friends, bring your family. It's an open invitation. It's not a private event or anything like that. Everyone is welcome. There's also time to pick up the official Sound Off Orlando t-shirt in our store on ProWrestlingTees.com. So hopefully I will see you all there. I'm very much looking forward to that. Audible is also offering a hell of a deal if you are a listener of this podcast. You got to take advantage of this. If you use our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster, you can sign up for a 30-day trial of the Audible service. Tons of books to choose from because you get one free book as part of your trial. So even if you cancel before the 30 days are over, you will not be billed. You get to keep one free audiobook of your choice, whatever it may be. I mentioned last week that there is a brand new book that is available for pre-order. It's not out yet, but AJ Lee has her book coming out at the beginning of next month, April 4th. So right after WrestleMania, the book drops, and it is shaping up to be a very interesting book. Apparently, there's some pretty interesting backstage stories in there from WWE. She also talks about her battle with bipolar and a lot of other things. So if you want to use your Audible trial to purchase, quote-unquote, purchase the AJ Lee book, you can get that book for free. It looks like she narrated all of the audio herself, hours and hours of audio narrated by AJ Lee herself. You can use our link right now. You don't have to wait until April. You can sign up and you can pre-order for free. And so when the book comes out at the beginning of next month, you will get the book. It's a hell of a deal. Take advantage of this because you never know how long it's going to last for. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Go through the sign-up process. Get your trial started and go ahead and pre-order the AJ Lee book. It's called Crazy Is My Superpower. That's the title of the book. Also, thank you to everybody who has been a big supporter of the podcast via PayPal. It's interesting. We were kind of having like a slow half of the first week. And then in the last like 48 hours, all of a sudden, I'm getting all these notifications. So thank you to everybody who made a contribution, big or small, to support the podcast. I really appreciate that. Of course, as you well know, $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout out here on the show. People really seem to dig that. You can always make a donation, by the way, if you want to, on thesolomonster.com. You'll find the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. And it's entirely up to you, you know, what, if anything, you'd like to contribute to show your support. I want to say thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, because it would not be a sound off if I didn't lead off with him. Deadpool James Herrera, Christian Combat Reyes, thank you very much for your generous donation. Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Yvonne Bruiser Balak, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Ladies Man Levi Daly, The Dark Serpent Derek Gibbs, Save the World Sean Tilly, Damn Straight Michael Dorsey, True Grit Tim Goggin, Canadian Destroyer Rob Morrow, Nemesis Nathan Moyers, Alvin Chainsaw Siegerts, Raymond the Mountie Medina, kind of a big deal, Corey Blake, who's celebrating a birthday this weekend, so happy birthday to Corey. He's actually celebrating at the WWE house show at Madison Square Garden today. I think the show actually starts in a few hours, so obviously I will not be there, but hopefully you'll have fun. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Mass Grave, Micah Harshaw, The Prince of Pleasantville, Anelio Crockett, Scott the Stump Woodford, All Day Long and All Night Too, Kyle Erickson, who wants to let everybody know that 2K Wrestling is a fantasy wrestling league that uses in-game characters in WWE 2K17 for the PlayStation 4 console. They're focused on creating a fun and competitive experience for everyone. So if you are into WWE 2K17, this may be right up your alley. Just search for the 2K Wrestling Facebook group. You can check out the rules. You can join their roster. It's very cool stuff. 2K Wrestling, by the players, for the players, is their mantra. So definitely check them out. Also, Jordan Ricafort, if you are listening to this, and I know you're not right now, but you will, Jordan turns 10 on March 15th, everybody. He is the one who made that awesome I'm a Sound Off Kid sign and took it to SmackDown a few weeks ago. He is having a birthday party today, and so the least I could do is wish Jordan a happy birthday here on the show. So, happy birthday, Jordan. Finally, the gentleman from the Bite That Wrestling Podcast wants you to know that if you have ever asked yourself, where can I find a WWE podcast with co-hosts from Canada, Puerto Rico, and Boston, one of whom was apparently attacked by a bear, which is actually kind of interesting. I'd like to know more about that. Look no further. You can check these guys out every Wednesday. Just search for Bite That. That's Bite That with a Y on iTunes, or you can go to BiteThat.com and check them out there. WWE Fastlane was last weekend. I have a full 40-minute review of the pay-per-view. I would have been better off reviewing the podcast. It would have been more of a thumbs up than this show was, but my full review for Fastlane is up on YouTube. I put it up as a Sound Off extra, so you can go check it out there. Obviously, a lot of very divided opinion on that main event. Goldberg squashing, which is exactly what it was. Goldberg squashed Kevin Owens. Now, I knew it was going to be a short match. I said it had to be a short match if Goldberg is to be the champion going into the main event of WrestleMania. A lot of people didn't like that when I suggested that all those weeks ago, but we see how this all played out. I will say I didn't see it going 21 seconds. That's not how I would have done it. You could do a short match. It doesn't have to be that short. So that pissed a lot of people off. Not one of their better pay-per-views. I think that's being kind. So if you want to hear my full review on Fastlane, that's the place to go. I have to lead, though, with TNA, or whatever they're calling themselves these days. I mean, how can I not after what happened this week? First of all, I had some people ask me if I was going to review the new era of Impact, right? The new and improved Impact Wrestling. I got through the first, I'd say maybe 15 minutes, and that was enough for me. Once they got to the announcer stuff, I mean, they opened with a pull-apart brawl with Eddie Edwards and Davey Richards, but the real kind of big angle, I guess, that they opened the show with was a fight between the announcers, which is always so compelling when you're trying to kick off a new era of any TV show, because that's what people want to see. They want to see a bunch of announcers bickering back and forth. So I see this, and I see Josh Matthews out there copying heel Michael Cole from 2011. Now, here's a word to the wise. We see recycled angles and characters in wrestling all the time. It's hard to innovate. I mean, everything in wrestling has been done. In some form or fashion, it has been done. The only thing that changes are the faces and the names, okay? And sometimes you could put a very unique spin on something. Oh, well, I never saw that version of it before, but almost everything has already been done in wrestling, okay? I get that. But if you're going to copy off of something from the past, at least copy off of something good. The Michael Cole stuff from 2011 sucked back then. And it's even shittier now using Josh Matthews. So I saw that and I had had enough. Somebody tweeted me a clip, I guess, from later in the show. There was a match between Rachel Ellering. I was surprised to see her there, but we've seen her on NXT before. Her father obviously works there, but they sent me this clip of, I guess there was a match between Rachel Ellering and Sienna, I think her name is. The bickering in this one, like, 15-second clip that this person sent me, the bickering between Borash and Matthews. Total garbage. Total garbage. So there's your review for those of you looking for that. I want to talk about the Hardys, though. Anthem, the big story this week, Anthem threatened to sue the Hardys if they continue to use the broken characters. They are claiming the gimmick is their intellectual property. It came out of a collaborative effort, they claim, not only with the Hardys, but also Jeremy Borash and Billy Corgan and Dave Lagana, who I just interviewed last week. I'll get back to him in a second. So when the hammer came down this week, and I guess they got served with whatever papers, Matt's wife, Rebby, went absolutely nuclear on Twitter. Here's a sample. I can't, you know, I'm not going to read every single tweet, but here's a sample of most of them here. Okay, these are Rebby's tweets once she found out that they were being threatened with a lawsuit by Anthem. She says, laughing my ass off, fuck you guys, at Ed Nordholm, Ed Nordholm being the head of Anthem, at Real Jeff Jarrett, and at Impact Wrestling. More than happy to play this game. Can we just talk about how many times Matt's contract could have been breached due to numerous issues on TNA's end? Funny thing is, everyone who has ever actually had anything to do with broken Matt Hardy has our back in this. Damn near 20% of your roster leaving in the span of 1 week, all citing the same reasons or none at all. What does that say to you? And then a fake-ass wishing-you-well tweet from Ed Nordholm mere hours before threatening to sue us. Such a fitting end, man. Seriously, you couldn't write this shit. Well, TNA couldn't write this shit. Any writer's worth a shit left, too. Real cute how TNA can go radio silent for weeks with the exception of nonsensical drunk texts from Jeff Jarrett. But we get a two-hour deadline to respond. Fuck you think this is, Taken? Everything these boys have done for the company and you want to try to fuck us for the sake of it. Literally no other reason except you mad. How about my husband leaving me a day after giving birth to make your TV tapings? That's how dedicated this MF-er was to the company. How about the three highest rated TV segments of 2016 were financed by the Hardys solely to help the product and because they believed in TNA? Or all the shit-talking by Jeff Jarrett throughout contract negotiations, and Matt was still there, professional, and trying to make things work for 2017. Oh, and this is the best part. These MFers trying to come after Senor Benjamin, my dad, by the way, who was never paid a dime by the company and who was obviously never under contract. Not that those contract things mean anything in TNA, until after they're over or until 3 days before they expire, apparently. Good luck explaining to your talent that their paychecks are late again because you're spending all of your money suing the Hardys. And fuck that owl. I'll get back to the owl in a minute. For those of you wondering, an owl? What the fuck is she talking about? I'll get back to that. But two things. One, I must know more about these Jeff Jarrett drunk texts. Okay, I have to know more about this. I would laugh if he was trying to sell them gold bars. And two, may God be with the person whoever cuts this woman off in traffic. I certainly never hope it's me. Anthem just comes off so badly here. And some people might say that Rebby does too, but I got a kick out of it. I could see some people looking at that and going, oh, that wasn't very smart of her to do. But to me, Anthem, they're the ones that just come off so badly here. Even if they are on solid legal footing with all of this, and we don't know all of the details, okay? We don't. Anybody who is out there, unless they're connected with Anthem or something, talking about things in definitive terms when it comes to this, they don't know, okay? Because we don't know all the details. We haven't seen the contracts and the wording in the contracts and all of that stuff. But even if they are on solid legal ground with this, they come off so scummy in how they went about this at a time when they are trying to relaunch a brand and build goodwill with their fans and bring in new fans. And springing this on them, you know, 2 hours with 2 hours notice allegedly to respond, doing it right before a Ring of Honor pay-per-view that the Hardys were set to appear on. That not only prevented them from doing the broken stuff, by the way, on Friday night, it potentially disrupted any plans that Ring of Honor may have had. You know, it could have ruined things for the fans. I don't know that it did, but, and by the way, most of the feedback that I've seen about that Ring of Honor pay-per-view is just outstanding. We may have a new, contender for show of the year, but, you know, let's say that Ring of Honor had something special planned around all the broken stuff. Maybe a fun vignette or some creative idea. Whatever it might have been, all of a sudden they have the rug pulled out from underneath them at the 11th hour. So to pull that kind of move and to send cease and desist letters to the pay-per-view companies carrying the Ring of Honor show on Friday night, Dish Network was the only one, but they backed down. They didn't even air the show. They pulled the entire show because of the threat of a lawsuit from Anthem. You know who that hurts? That hurts Ring of Honor. That hurts the fans. So, that's not cool. That's not cool. There had to be a better way to go about doing this. That's really what rubbed me the wrong way. When I heard about the letters to the pay-per-view companies and all that, you know, it's like, that to me is where it's just becomes ridiculous. I mean, they had time to send those letters out without waiting until the very last minute and saying, hey guys, you know, ROH, hey, just be aware that, you know, we've got this going on. These characters, you know, belong to us. You know, to do it, you know, the way they did it, I think was just a scumbag move. That's what it was. Ryan Satin on ProWrestlingSheet.com, he was reporting that Anthem does not want to permanently prevent the Hardys from using the broken gimmick. That's not their end goal here. And they're not planning on taking those characters and giving them to anyone else. What they want to do is work out a deal that gives them a cut of any future money that is derived from the use of those characters, which realistically would kill, I would think, would kill any chance of them using those characters in WWE, because there's no way WWE is ever going to agree to that. There's no way. I don't see that happening. Now, I am going to offer a small defense of Anthem here. Ed Nordholm, what Rebbe said is true. Hours before all of this went down, you can go check out his Twitter timeline. He posted a tweet, you know, basically praising the work of Matt Hardy, and he also was very strategic in what he did, tagging Jeremy Borash, Billy Corgan, and Billy Corgan is another one who had issues with TNA and Dixie and Anthem, right? And so it's not as though Anthem hasn't had their issues with other people before, but it's very interesting seeing them tag Borash, Corgan, and Lagana on Twitter in that same tweet. It was a very interesting, very strategic move. It was a way for him to point out that, hey, these guys were also involved in coming up with these characters. It wasn't a one-man show here. And yes, all of the little intricacies of the Broken Hardy characters and the whole Broken universe that Matt created with King Maxwell and Senor Benjamin and Smokin' Joe Frazier the Kangaroo and everything. This whole universe that this guy created, it may well have been the brainchild of Matt Hardy, but there is at least some validity to what Anthem is arguing here. And I have a clip I want to play for you right now, and I think that this is relevant to all of this. Little did I know how relevant it would be when I asked him about this, not even two full weeks ago, but I happened to interview Dave Lagana, who was tagged in that tweet by Ed Nordholm. And Lagana spent 5 years in a creative role working for TNA up until November. And I asked Lagana about the Broken Hardy stuff. This was right after the news came that they either left or they were about to leave and they might go to WWE. This was before the shit hit the fan here. And I asked him about the Hardys. That was one of the questions I had on my list to ask him about. And I want to play that audio right now because I think it's relevant, especially to the point that Anthem is trying to make. And if we're being fair here, we have to point out both sides. So here is that snippet from my interview with Dave Lagana. TNA's made quite a bit of news this week. Drew Galloway, the Hardys leaving the company, among others. I would imagine in your position there, you must have worked with them a lot. What do you think of those guys, and what do you think of this whole broken universe that Matt has created for himself?
Well, that's the good part of last year, and the same with Drew. Like, we worked with talent, and it's funny, a picture popped up in my Facebook time hop thingy they have. Like, I had completely forgot Big Money Matt. Like, think about that. Big Money Matt was really cool. Like, he did a really great character, and that was just got wiped out last year. Nobody remembers that. It was like Rebbe and Spud and Tyrus. Like, he had this really cool thing last year that in any other year would have been a spectacular character, and he was really good at it. He just – we got to this point in the story with Jeff. We did the I Quit thing, and it was just this idea we had, and again – idea. It was like, what if you just went dark? And it was just until you beat your brother again, you went dark. That's where it started, and you saw where he took it. And JB did a lot of great work with him, and Jimmy did a lot of great work. This guy Ben, everybody pitched in, and that's the thing. It's no one singular person. And that's when it's really good, is when people are throwing ideas. Billy Corgan went to Cameron, North Carolina for Delete or Decay, and stayed up all night with them. Like, these people just worked all hard as a team.
So there it is. I mean, I thought it was timely to replay that clip because Lagana does talk about initially pitching the idea for Matt to go dark, as he called it. And then guys like Borash and Billy helping out, working as a team, they may well have the legal standing to lay claim to these characters. I mean, this is a situation that could actually end in Anthem's favor. We'll see how it all plays out. We'll see if they go to court, if they actually do sue them, or maybe they'll reach some sort of an understanding. After Rebby's tirade on Twitter, I think that seems less likely, but look, it's her family. I think any one of us in her position would be just as pissed off as she is. And she has every right to be pissed off. She sees how hard her husband has worked on this. You know, she may know a lot more than she's even letting on in those tweets. There may be more stuff coming out. You know, she's also claimed that Matt's contract did not include any exclusivity, which means he would have been free and clear to appear on any televised program while still under contract at TNA. I'm not sure how that would have worked, but that's, and I find that hard to believe, but it's TNA we're talking about here, so maybe I shouldn't find it so hard to believe. That's what she claims. But here's the other thing. They went after her father. And I think that really, more than anything, is probably what just pushed her over the edge. They went after her father, who apparently was never under contract at TNA. He was never even compensated, according to her, by TNA anyway, for any of the work that he did in all of those skits and all of those segments. Now imagine getting a legal letter hours before a pay-per-view show threatening your entire family, okay? Right? There's a lot more to the story than we know. So we have to just let it play out. But my initial reaction is Anthem handled this very poorly. And you could argue that Rebby did too by going public with those tweets, especially if this does go to court, it could come back to bite her. But I imagine, you know, Anthem just looks terrible in how they're treating this entire family. And the Hardy stuff was the only reason that, for example, I gave TNA a look in these last few months, because it was different. It was different. It was funny. It was interesting. I think we need more of that in wrestling. I was just talking about earlier how hard it is to do anything new in wrestling because everything's already been done. Well, here's something that, you know, Matt Hardy came up with that I certainly don't ever remember seeing in wrestling before. He created this entire universe and people just got wrapped up in it. And maybe it wasn't everyone's cup of tea. I mean, initially, I know it did pretty well. It popped a big number or two for TNA. And it's not like all of the Hardy stuff has been doing gangbuster ratings. The numbers have gone down since then. So maybe people got tired of it. But there's a lot of people out there who are big fans of the whole broken universe and the broken characters. And again, that was the one thing about TNA in the last 6 months that drew me in. It was like, wow, this looks kind of entertaining and interesting, and I'm going to give this a shot. I'm not going to really pay attention to any of the other stuff. But, you know, Final Deletion and all of that stuff, I watched that, and I enjoyed it. I thought it was brilliant what they were able to come up with. And that's, you know, part of the reason why I love Lucha Underground. I mean, some people hate it, but I do think it gets a little ridiculous in Lucha Underground with some of the stuff they've done. But again, it's over the top. You've got spacemen, and you've got demons, and you've got all that stuff, and you either are into that stuff or you're not. But it's one of the things that I came to love about Lucha Underground, so to each their own. But what Matt Hardy has done, the way he's reinvented himself, was one of the great wrestling stories of 2016, and it sucks that it's turning into one of the great disasters so far of 2017. I just think there had to be a better way to handle this before it even got to this point. And the fact that the Hardys are hardly the only ones to leave TNA in the last few weeks, you know, Drew Galloway flat out admitted if Anthem had its shit together and got back to him with an offer 3 weeks before they did, he'd still be on Impact. Not only would he still be on Impact, but he'd be their champion right now. But they dragged their feet and they waited until the last minute and they pulled the same shit with the Hardys, okay? So that's three of their biggest stars right there. Galloway, Matt Hardy, and Jeff Hardy. And if that's how they treat their top talent, then I guess we shouldn't be surprised at how petty they're behaving right now. And to be fair, because I know there's going to be some people and some TNA fans who throw this in my face, WWE is not much better. I am well aware of the situation with Cody Rhodes, and I think that is awful. I think that is an awful situation. I think WWE looks so bad in that situation. It's the same thing, you know? They may well be within their legal right to stop him from using the Rhodes name outside of WWE, but that doesn't mean that they should. That doesn't make it right. The guy's father was using the Rhodes name long before Vince McMahon ever took his own company over from his dad. And they're going to tell him, you're not a Rhodes anymore. You're not allowed to call yourself a Rhodes. It's horseshit. Of course it is. It is bullshit. And WWE looked every bit as bad as Anthem does here. But that doesn't make this any less right. So now, back to the owl. Impact went on Twitter this week to ask people to help name the Anthem Owl. Anthem Sports and Entertainment has a goddamn owl in its logo. Don't ask me why, but they do. I haven't got the foggiest idea. After this week, it should probably be a donkey or something like that. So they asked the fans, help us give this owl a name. I think the deadline is tomorrow. And my suggestion was Bowel. I thought Bowel the Owl would be an appropriate name. But there have been lots of others, and I just want to read a small sample of some of the suggestions that people have submitted on Twitter. Dixie, of course, a popular choice. Vince Husso is another. I guess instead of who, it says bro over and over again. Would not take very long for that owl to get shot. Owl Wilson was another suggestion. Owl Snow. Aldo Montoya. These are really bad. The one that actually made me laugh was Claire Lynch. I'd forgotten about her. And I think naming the owl Claire Lynch would actually be very appropriate. But my personal favorite, a nice homage, I think, to TNA's past, Chapter 11 was another suggestion. Isn't that the name of the girl from Stranger Things? Right? 11. I think her name is 11. But I actually agree with Rebby Sky. Fuck that owl. I encourage everybody to tweet that hashtag on Thursdays whenever Impact goes on the air. Hashtag fuck that owl. By the way, I mentioned the Ring of Honor pay-per-view on Friday. It was their 15th anniversary show. I want to say congratulations to Christopher Daniels. He beat Adam Cole to become the new ROH World Champion. First time ever in his career. Chris Daniels, I did not realize this, but Chris Daniels wrestled in the main event of the very first Ring of Honor show way back in 2002. It was a triple threat with Daniel Bryan back in his Bryan Danielson days, and Loki. And so here's a guy in the very first ROH main event, and 15 years later, he wins the world title. I just think that's a great story. We got two more wrestling deaths to talk about, which brings the total to far too many. Not even a full 3 months here into the year. Actually, you could argue that it's three wrestling-related deaths if you add Lou Duva to the list. Duva was a famous boxing trainer who was in Roddy Piper's corner for his boxing match with Mr. T at WrestleMania 2. He died this week also. But Tom Jones, who was someone I was not familiar with, but Mick Foley wrote a very nice blog post about how helpful he was to him early in his career. He passed away after a battle with dementia. Wrestled from the mid-60s to the late 80s, all over the place, Georgia, Florida, California. He also trained a number of wrestlers. The other name who died this week is a name that I do know from his time, at least in WWE in the late 80s, which was actually the final run of his career. He retired right after that. Outlaw Ron Bass, who died at 68 this week from a ruptured appendix. Apparently his appendix burst, and he didn't even know it. And it was a week that went by before he finally realized, hey, something's wrong here. And by then it was too late. His body had been poisoned by all of the toxins. His biggest success came in Florida. He had a big, big feud with Dusty Rhodes. I remember him bringing the bullwhip to the ring. Miss Betsy, he called it. I remember his feud with Brutus the Barber Beefcake. I remember the hair match they had on Saturday night's main event. I mean, all that stuff goes back to when I was a kid. Beefcake shaving his head, which I think might have been right before he left the company, because I don't think he did anything after that. But interestingly, he becomes the fifth wrestler to die this year alone who was either among the plaintiffs in that concussion lawsuit against WWE or who WWE preemptively sued because they thought they were about to join the lawsuit. Five people, Jimmy Snuka, Chavo Sr., Ivan Koloff, and Timothy Well from Well Done. They were the other four. And now Ron Bass makes five. So how long do you think before we start getting the conspiracy theories that WWE is slowly bumping off each guy on that list? I think Marty Jannetty better watch out. Speaking of Marty Jannetty, this would be your sad tweet of the week if it was posted on Twitter, but it wasn't. It was posted on Facebook by Marty Jannetty. He posted this on Tuesday. He said, to all my ninjas, I want y'all's advice. Actually, you know what? If we're going to do this, we may as well do it right. Hold on here. To all my ninjas, I want y'all's advice. Just got a call, 150 G's for three movies. Porno movies. Can't say the name, but they're a big company. I'm thinking my bro Snoop had something to do with this. Check this, though. I'd get to tear up some beautiful bitches. But as my brother said, my family could see that. My thought is, why is my family watching porno then gonna judge me? What do y'all think on that? Well, he does have a point there. That would be weird. $150,000, I call bullshit. $150, maybe. That I could believe. Not $150,000. Bushwhacker Luke was on Sean Waltman's podcast, and I know, you know, I'm talking Marty Jannetty and porn, and now I mentioned Bushwhacker Luke. This is like the worst porn movie ever, but just bear with me here. Bushwhacker Luke was on Sean Waltman's podcast, and he talked about trying to get Marty some help. He was going to get him to DDP and have DDP help try to turn his life around the way he did with Jake and Scott, but I guess on the day that he was supposed to meet with Marty, Marty just no-showed. He never showed up. Jannetty just, you know, the dude just wants to party and have fun. Like, whenever he posts these status updates or I see pictures of him, it's like, how old is he? He's got to be 50 years old now. I mean, he doesn't look a day over 60. I mean, you could tell he's a partier. He probably just kind of binges all night long doing God knows what. But he's, you know, he's an older guy now, and he just seems like one of those guys that never really matured. I mean, I think he comes across like a complete mess, personally. And I hope he got his ankle fixed, because I remember him having ankle issues and showing a picture of his ankle, and it was like, ugh, God, it was disgusting. But, you know, Jannetty was a really talented guy who I think gets a bad rap, and it sucks for him because he's become a punchline. He's become, you know, when you talk about tag teams breaking up, I mean, I still get questions in the mailbag. Who do you think is going to be the Jannetty of this team? And it's like, man, this poor fucker here, his whole career has been followed by this because he never achieved the same level of success that Shawn Michaels did. Well, you know what? Maybe he would have, but that's his own fault. He got fired a whole bunch of times. WWE still brought him back, but he got fired because, not because of something that somebody else did to him, but because he would screw up. And he would do things that he shouldn't be doing. So he got fired. It's not anybody else's fault. And it's too bad because, you know, he can never get his shit together. And I think he's somebody who could have contributed a lot at a place like right now, like the Performance Center. They're bringing in guys left and right to do guest coaching and to be coaches. And you look at some of the guys down there. They had Billy Gunn and they've had a whole bunch of guys like that coming in. It's not like, you know, the Performance Center is just stocked with this main event level talent coaching staff. Oh, had to be guys who are in main events. No, you got guys like Terry Taylor and you had Bill DeMott running the whole thing, for crying out loud. Bill DeMott was never a big, big star, but that doesn't mean that you don't have a lot to offer. And I think Jannetty would have fit that bill perfectly, but WWE would be out of their friggin' mind to bring that guy in and do anything with him. And it's a shame. It's just a complete waste of talent. Sami Zayn gave an interview to the UK Sun this week. Now that I got the TNA stuff off my chest, I can direct my fire somewhere else. Sami Zayn was asked about veteran stars like Goldberg and Brock Lesnar taking spots from the younger talent at the top of the card, and this is what he said. And again, what I'm going to talk about, it's not really directed at Sami. I'm using Sami's comments, though, as kind of a stepping stone to something else, I think is a bigger issue. But this is what Sami said. He said, selfishly, of course, part of me thinks, hey, get the hell out of here. This is our show. We work here every week. It would be stupid to ignore that. I can say a lot about Kevin Owens, but I've also seen him busting his ass for the last 8 months as Universal Champion, doing street fights at the live events, going through tables every night, getting beaten up. So personal feelings aside, do you think, man, that guy works hard all year. He deserves to be rewarded when the time is right. But at the same time, Brock Lesnar or Bill Goldberg coming in, the fans like it, it's good for business, and if it's good for business, it's good for me in a roundabout way. Do I wish I was main eventing WrestleMania and not Bill Goldberg? Yes, absolutely. But you know, it might be better in some way to bring these guys in to help business. If it's helping business, it's helping me. If you remember when The Rock came back in 2011, 2012, for that first match with John Cena at WrestleMania, there were rumors and there were rumblings that some of the talent backstage was very upset about Rock coming in and taking a spot away from them. And I went off on how dumb that was because Rock coming in was the best thing for that WrestleMania. That WrestleMania did a huge number. They did big business that year. And the guy is one of the biggest movie stars in the world. He's from Miami. You've got WrestleMania in Miami. You're looking to pack this giant stadium. I mean, it would have been idiotic. It would have been business malpractice not to try to get Rock in for that show. And if Rock was coming in, he could only be the main event. So it is refreshing to see somebody who gets it. Sami Zayn gets it. He understands. But I don't want people to think that this gets WWE off the hook for doing a piss-poor job of creating a whole new generation of Goldbergs and Brock Lesnars. I mean, I know there are some guys that come along, like a Brock Lesnar, who there aren't very many people like him. You can't just, you know, they don't grow on friggin' trees. But look at the last 15, 16, 17 years, and you tell me they've done a great job of creating the next big crop of these larger-than-life, big-time stars. I'll sit here and I'll let you try to come up with an answer for that one. I'm not saying that they haven't made stars. We're not talking stars. Anybody can be a star. You can put somebody on TV and people start chanting for them. Oh, all of a sudden they're a star. Dean Ambrose, you could say, is a star. Seth Rollins is a star. Okay, but that's not the level of star I'm talking about here. Had they done a better job of doing that over the last 15 years, they wouldn't have to bring back Goldberg. They wouldn't have to put the title on Brock Lesnar and have no title matches on their house shows for 6 months. They wouldn't have to rely so much on the part-timers. You can bring them in. There's nothing wrong with bringing them in. I like seeing some of these guys. I like Goldberg. I don't have a problem with Goldberg. Goldberg brings an intensity and a realism that not very many guys on that roster have. There is a place for Goldberg on that roster. I don't hate Goldberg. I don't want to see Goldberg banished into the wilderness. He was in the wilderness with this company for over a decade. It's nice to see him back. I don't have an issue with that. But they would not have to rely so much on these guys if they had just done a better job. You know, WWE has become one of the great part-time employers in this country over the last few years. And they bear a good part of the blame for that. And I think they bear a good part of the blame for why guys like Kevin Owens and Dean Ambrose and Dolph Ziggler, who's been around for how many years now, why they don't feel anywhere near as special as the guys do from that era. And I'm not saying that every single guy that comes from the indies and out of NXT can be the next Goldberg. Kevin Owens, maybe he's right at the level he would have been at anyway. And you take Kevin Owens and you drop him into the Attitude Era, I don't know if Kevin Owens is a main event guy or not. They had a lot of really talented guys back then. Maybe he would have. Maybe Kevin Owens would have fit right in with those guys. He could have been somebody who, you know, Steve Austin stunnered and pinned. We'll never know. Some guys would have fit in well in that era. Other guys would have been eaten alive. Who's to say? Mankind didn't exactly have a great physique. It wasn't just about physiques back then. It was about characters. And if Kevin Owens came in and was compelling enough, and it was the Attitude Era, so Kevin Owens could probably go out there and have a lot more freedom to say and do things he can't do now. Who are you? Who am I to say that Kevin Owens could not have been a big star in that era? Friggin', you know, X-Pac and Billy Gunn were big stars. Almost anybody who got any semblance of a push was a big star. But you have these guys like an Ambrose or a Ziggler who's been around for so many years. Why do they not feel anywhere near as special as the guys did from that era? Why does it feel like just two completely, totally different eras of wrestling? Those guys were larger than life. And I'm not just talking about physically. A lot of them were big guys. A lot of them were jacked to the gills. But you had smaller guys also. You had heavier guys, fat guys, whatever you want to call them. They weren't all necessarily tall and muscular, who got over, and they were big, big stars. You could be the most talented guy in the world, but you're only as good as they allow you to be. That's a lot. I'll never forget when I interviewed Bob Holly. I mean, he basically said the same thing. And he said that in his book, too. You're only as good as they allow you to be. Doesn't matter what you did in Japan, what you did in another company. It doesn't matter if the entire building is chanting your name. You are only going to be as big as they allow you to be. That's how you end up with someone like AJ Styles wrestling Shane McMahon at WrestleMania. And I'm not trying to say that AJ's been, you know, screwed by WWE. I've been very impressed at the level that AJ Styles has been out since he came in. I'm just using this WrestleMania as an example of when they're not really focused on you, you know, you end up in a situation where a guy like AJ Styles, who could, you know, do something very special, I think, at a WrestleMania with anybody on that roster and can go out there and just have a very memorable match and they can build a story around it. This feels very thrown together. It feels like an afterthought. It feels like, all right, AJ just wasn't a priority for us. And so, you know, Shane's a big star, and so we'll give him a big match. We'll put him in there with Shane. But that's why a lot of people are not very happy and not very excited about that match. It feels like the guy's an afterthought. Dolph Ziggler. Dolph Ziggler could he have been a bigger star? We'll never know. I've really soured on Dolph. I just find myself not giving a shit, frankly, about Dolph Ziggler these days. And I think it's finally happened. I mean, you know, talk about the broken Hardys. It's broken Dolph, because the guy's broke. There's no fixing him. He's been around for so long. There's all the start and stop stuff with this guy. And, you know, he got hurt a couple times too. But they've done a piss poor job of trying to get this guy over as anything really special, because he's been beaten down and beaten down and beaten down for so long. There's a reason he comes out now, and some nights he gets crickets, and people just don't care, because after a while, you know, you don't give them a reason to care. They're not going to care. I cared at one point. Now I don't. I'm in that camp, and there's a lot of people like me out there, and it's a shame, because Dolph's a talented guy. Would he have been a top guy if they would have gone all the way with him? Who the hell knows? I don't know. He's got the talent. I don't think, you know, in the ring, anybody can doubt that this guy can go. He could hang. He can make other people look good, right? That was always a hallmark of people like Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels. Could he have been at that level? You know, I don't think so necessarily. Maybe a step below, but, you know, he's not even a step below. He's like, you know, 10 stories below. But every time they would start to do something with him, they would immediately turn him into friggin' Lieutenant Dan from Forrest Gump and cut the guy's legs off. And again, he got the concussion that one time when he was the world champion. I mean, that Money in the Bank cash in after WrestleMania will go down as the highlight of this guy's career. Then he got hurt through no fault of his own. He got kicked in the head by Jack Swagger. It wasn't his fault. And that wasn't even WWE's fault. It was a freak deal. You know, but what about all the other times? All the start and stop nonsense with this guy over the years. What if they've gone all the way last year with Dean Ambrose? What if they didn't put Ryback in that Hell in a Cell match against CM Punk? Or if they did, but they put the title on him? They've spent over 15 years trying to make the next Steve Austin. You know that they would love to have themselves another Stone Cold or Rock. John Cena is the closest thing to anything like that in terms of star power that they have created. And there is a noticeable difference at the live events that John Cena is on compared to the ones that he's not. The guy moves tickets. The guy's a mover. But he's also going to be 40. And he's doing movies. Now I see he's going to be off again for many months after WrestleMania. He's all but a part-timer now, it feels like. And he comes, he goes, he comes, he goes. Can you even imagine someone like Rock or Steve Austin coming along today? I mean, forget the language. Because those guys, I mean, to be fair, I mean, those guys did rely a lot on the foul language and stuff to, you know, to pop big one-liners and get over. But it's not like that's the only reason Rock and Stone Cold were successful, because they went out there and they used, you know, curse words. Forget that for a second. Do you honestly believe Rock or Steve Austin, first coming along now and getting that big push in WWE, would explode and get over the way they did back then? I don't think so. Not at that level. Not anywhere close. So when we all sit around wondering, you know, who's the next Rock? Who's the next Stone Cold? You know, I laughed last year when people said, this was during the period where Ambrose started to get real hot. And people said, oh, Dean Ambrose, he's going to be the next Stone Cold. And then he went on Stone Cold's podcast. And he got called out for not working hard enough. You know, I feel like Ambrose was just never the same after that. But this idea, who's the next this? Who's the next that? All of us, we all need to stop doing that, because there is no next anyone. There's that era and there's this era. And they are nothing alike. So yes, Sami Zayn is dead on in that. Bringing in guys like Goldberg, I think, can help everyone. It also does hurt them, because it highlights that these 50-year-old guys are much bigger stars than 99% of their own roster. And it's not because AJ Styles isn't talented enough. It's not because Samoa Joe isn't talented enough. It's because WWE has created this system of booking that is, it just makes it almost impossible for anyone to get to that level anymore. It is a self-fulfilling prophecy. We'll do this bipolar booking with these guys, and then when they don't get above a certain level, when it doesn't work, well, see, we tried, but they're not getting the job done. You know, it's like, hey, what's Austin doing? I know he retired the same year as frickin' Finding Nemo came out, but let's put him on the cover of our new video game next year. Right? This is what you end up with. This is what happens. Now, Sammy made another point in this interview that I want to address. He said he would like to see more of a mix of past talents with the newer talents. This is what he said. He said, for me, it's really cool to see a guy like Chris Jericho come back for this past year or two. He's mixed it up with all of us. I want to see a guy from a past generation, how he's going to fare against our generation. That's a cool and interesting thing for me to see. That's what made The Rock versus Hulk Hogan so interesting. Obviously, they're two of the biggest icons in our industry, but still, it was a generational clash. A clash of the past against the present and the future. I guess it's cool to see these two mammoths in Brock and Goldberg go at it, but I would rather see Brock and Kevin Owens. I would rather see Goldberg and me, or Seth Rollins or Roman Reigns. As a fan, I want to see the last generation mix it up with this one. He's not wrong. In theory, it would be very cool to see that. But I say, be careful what you wish for. He said this coming off Kevin Owens getting demolished by Bill Goldberg in 21 seconds. And maybe he did the interview before the pay-per-view. I don't know. But, you know, this thing ran, and I'm reading this after having just seen Goldberg squash this guy in 21 seconds, okay? And that's probably not the best example of how to do past generation against current generation. But, you know, once they made the call to do Lesnar and Goldberg at Mania for the title, it had to be done. Maybe not in 21 seconds, but it had to be done. But, you know, at least CM Punk was competitive in there against The Rock, right? But that's another example. They did Rock and Punk, and Rock won both matches. He beat Punk twice. And Punk is supposed to be, again, one of the biggest, like, number one or two stars in the entire company here in this era. And here comes The Rock, and I know he's The Rock, you know, and he's older, but he's not that old. All of that is true, but he comes in, again, at least it was competitive, but he comes in and beats the guy twice. This is exactly what I'm talking about. I think Samoa Joe and Brock Lesnar would be a great smash-mouth match, but what good does it do Joe if he gets suplexed for 10 minutes and pinned? So I think for everyone clamoring for matches like that, I say be careful what you wish for. Because all it does is reinforce the idea that those guys are better than the new guys. You know, when Batista came back, Batista got a raw deal. And he even admits, you know, that entire run for him was just miserable. And it wasn't his fault. But you know what? Batista tapped out to Daniel Bryan in the main event of WrestleMania. And I don't think that guy gets enough credit for that. That was a big deal. It would have been very easy to have Randy Orton be the one to do it. It was a triple threat match, but they didn't. It was Batista. Batista agreed to do it. And then Batista, when he was back as part of Evolution for those couple of months, he helped put over the Shield guys. Batista is a great example of how to use a big star from the past to help elevate new talent and give those guys more credibility. And I'm not saying that the old star should just lose every single match. It's not what I'm saying. Because what happens then is you end up with Chris Jericho. And I love Chris Jericho to death, okay? This run that he just had and that he's on right now, I guess, is the second best ever, as far as I'm concerned, of this guy's entire career. It's only second to the heel run he had in 08 with Shawn Michaels. But if Jericho has a fault, it's that he has been too giving of himself. Rock was like that. When Rock was full-time, Rock lost a lot of matches. You go back and look at the number of matches Rock lost compared to Stone Cold, or even Triple H probably. I mean, The Rock was very giving of himself. He lost a lot of matches. Him and Jericho both probably were the two most selfless. And I guess you could throw Foley in there, but Rock and Jericho were probably the two most selfless big stars of that entire era. And you could throw Ric Flair in there too while you're at it. It doesn't get no bigger than that, and Flair lost a lot of matches. Flair lost matches he wasn't even in because Hulk Hogan didn't want to lose. I remember a Hogan-Vader strap match, somehow Flair lost. Go explain that one. Okay? So they were some of the most selfless stars of that entire era. But, you know, with Jericho, when you have him jobbing to Fandango at WrestleMania, I mean, that might have been a bridge too far. Now, to his credit, Jericho wanted to wrestle Ryback on that WrestleMania, and I'm sure he would have put Ryback over. Ryback was a big star who was getting over. Ryback was on the ascent until he wasn't. And Ryback could have gone a hell of a lot further than he did, but instead Mark Henry fell on him and pinned him. And then he wrestled Cena for the championship. That's an interesting order of events. Ryback goes undefeated for months and months, then he starts to lose. He loses every single pay-per-view match, Mark Henry falls on him at WrestleMania, and the next night, let's turn him heel and have him wrestle for the championship. Good job, guys. Good job. So, as much as I agree, it would be very cool to see past versus present, the only past star I can see them bringing back and actually putting over the newer guys and having it mean something would be Kurt Angle. Imagine Kurt Angle against Seth Rollins. Imagine Angle against Balor or Angle against Cesaro, right? Those are the kind of matches that I would like to see. And I think those guys could really benefit from. But WWE does not have the best track record when it comes to how they handle past against present. And that's how we end up with a match like Goldberg against Brock Lesnar as our WrestleMania main event. And if they do headline, if those two guys go on last, that's been the rumor for weeks and weeks now. Vince McMahon has Goldberg and Lesnar, not Orton and Bray, obviously Jericho and Owens now isn't for the title. It's Goldberg and Brock as the main event of WrestleMania. If those guys go on last, that would make six straight WrestleManias with at least one part-time performer in the main event. How's that for a stat? Think about that. Raw this past Monday was live from Chicago, Illinois. Raw Twitter poll, almost 2,500 of you voted. 52% thumbs up, 48% thumbs down. So back in positive territory. This was a weird show. I actually thought the first half was really good. If the show would have ended 90 minutes in with Lesnar giving Goldberg the F5, if that would have been the final kind of scene of the show, it would have been a total thumbs up from me. But the tag title stuff is just not doing anything for me. Then we got the obligatory New Day Shining Travel Agents match. The women's stuff, That's kind of how I feel about it right now. The show really slowed down for me in the second half. So, 52-48 sounds about right to me. I thought the Chris Jericho-Kevin Owens segment was really good. I loved Owens explaining to Jericho that you were never my best friend. I used you. You were a tool for me. And the moment you accepted that match with Goldberg on my behalf for the Universal title, I knew the charade was over. I don't know what their plans were on how to end this before Goldberg came back because, you know, they started the best friend stuff with Jericho and Owens, last summer. When they started that, Goldberg hadn't even wrestled Brock yet. I don't even know if he had reached a deal with them. So they could not have known at that point that they would be putting the championship on the guy. I mean, that certainly they didn't know back in the summer. But I love what they did here. Babyface Jericho, to me, has always been a lot less entertaining than heel Jericho. I just don't think Jericho's ever been a really great babyface. I just don't. I think he's a born and bred heel. I think that's where he's always excelled. All the classic great moments of Jericho's career, most, if not all of them, came during his various heel runs, even going back to when he was the conspiracy victim in WCW in 98. The guy is a heel. That's what he is. And babyface Jericho will be very popular at first. He's very popular right now, but it will always fizzle out. And for now, again, he's very popular. It's hard to argue with what they're doing here. Jericho said that they would fight at WrestleMania, and Kevin Owens wanted him to put the U.S. title on the line, which Jericho agreed to without hesitation. They brawled. Samoa Joe came out. He was assisting Kevin Owens, which is interesting because there's been a lot of rumors about there being a Triple H faction of some kind post-WrestleMania, and maybe Owens and Joe would be part of it, and I've kind of explained my take on that. I don't know why Triple H has to be involved beyond day one. I would like to see these guys kind of stand on their own two feet, but we'll see if they actually go through with it. So it was interesting to see them working together here. Sami Zayn ran down with a chair. In the middle of all this, Jericho got the chair, and he accidentally caught Owens with a chair shot to the head. So I wonder if Vince made Jericho sit in a room when the show was over and watch the replay on a loop from five different angles, like the Zapruder film, the way he did when he and Batista got blood in their cage match on Raw. That's one of the stories actually from Jericho's third book, which, by the way, you can get for free using our Audible link. Cheap plug. See, I always try to work those in there. I learned from Mick Foley. So this led to Owens against Zayn. Zayn did a somersault plancha over the referee out onto Owens. That was probably the highlight of the match. I mean, it had to be the highlight of the match. It went 3.5 minutes. You know what that is? That's the Bayley-Sasha spot from their match at TakeOver in Brooklyn. That's how I'm sure it's been done a million times before, but I'm just thinking back. That's what I remember it from. So Owens finished him off shortly thereafter with a pop-up powerbomb. You know, poor Sammy. First Joe kills him. Now Owens kills him. Austin Aries. Can we talk about Austin Aries here for a few minutes? Austin Aries was one of the highlights of this entire show. First of all, he introduced us all to his package. Okay, then he did commentary for the Cruiserweight title match. We had a Cruiserweight title match between Neville and Rich Swann. This was a really fun match. The crowd was into it, which they're not always with these Cruiserweight matches. They gave them time. This went almost 15 minutes. Swann missed the Phoenix Splash. Neville applied the Rings of Saturn. He got the submission. After the match, Aries interviewed Neville in the ring. Talked about how there's no one on 205 Live that can hold a candle to me. And, oh, that's very poor. I'm sorry. Fans chanted Austin Aries. This irritated Neville. Neville told him to go back to the commentator's table. He threatened to re-break his orbital bone, his orbital socket. By the way, Aries, when he took his sunglasses off, his eye looked pretty beaten up all these months later. So that must have been a hell of a kick that Nakamura gave him. His eye is like permanently disfigured. Well, I'm making it sound worse than it is, but if you look at the eye compared to his one uninjured eye, you can see the difference, the scar, and it just looks weird. So Aries said, okay, I'll go back to the announce desk, but I've got one more question. He said, actually, it's not so much a question, it's more of a statement. And with that, he decked Neville, came off the ropes with a wicked roaring elbow. Huge reaction for Austin Aries. And that looks to be your Cruiserweight title match for WrestleMania, and that is fine by me. I was dreading them just taking 6 or 8 Cruiserweights and just throwing them in a match without any real attention paid to story or anything like that. Well, now they've got a story. Austin Aries is back. He's out to prove that he is the top Cruiserweight. You've got two of the best performers in the entire company. And they're going to go to WrestleMania and they're going to get a chance to just show the world what they can do. That's what it's all about. That could steal the show. I'm looking at this WrestleMania card. It looks like they got 15 matches this year. That's the match to watch for. If they give them time, those guys can steal the show. The new Universal Champion Goldberg came out here in Chicago. He got a mix of cheers and boos. You know, I was thinking about this. Goldberg, for the most part, has gotten pretty good reactions since he came back. And I do worry that the fans are starting to either tire of Goldberg, or given the audience that you typically have at a WrestleMania and Raw the night after, you're going to have a lot of smart-ass people who just want to try to recreate WrestleMania 20. I hope that doesn't happen. I mean, they've built this story up. You know, they have a story. They've been building it up for months. I'd like for there to at least be a decent payoff to this in the end, whatever that turns out to be. We don't need the crowd to shit on these two guys. I think Goldberg has been used exactly as how Goldberg should probably be used. You could argue Brock hasn't, but I assume Brock's getting the belt in the end, so it won't matter. But hopefully for those guys' sake, they don't go out there and it'll be different because WrestleMania 20 was in a much smaller building. It would be a lot easier in a building like Madison Square Garden to get the crowd to just boo the shit out of these two guys. If you're in an outdoor stadium and you've got 50,000 people, I think it's going to be a lot harder for that to happen. So I don't foresee that exactly going down the way it did. But look, if they put them on last, if these guys are really the main event, you could potentially have a big problem here where the people turn on these guys something bad. So they gotta be mindful of that. There were some CM Punk chants here during the segment. Bill acknowledged them almost on cue. Out came Paul Heyman. It was almost like, all right, send him out. So out came Heyman. He introduced Brock Lesnar, who got in the ring. He went eye to eye with Goldberg. And this is what I mean. When they went eye to eye, there was a big time buzz. It wasn't like people booed that. right, or sat on their hands. When these guys were nose-to-nose in the middle of the ring, two big bulls going face-to-face, the crowd, there was a buzz. The crowd was buzzing for this. Heyman said Lesnar came here to shake Goldberg's hand. Goldberg wasn't buying it. Obviously, they're very happy that Brock's match now is a championship match. Heyman said there would be a new champion crowned at WrestleMania, and when the match is over, everybody can look at Goldberg and say, there he is, Brock's bitch. This set off Goldberg, and before he could go after Heyman, Brock picked him up and delivered an F5. And it was funny because Goldberg was like stiff as a board. He was holding the title on his shoulder when Brock picked him up, and it's like he stayed frozen in that position. He still held the title. Finally, he dropped the friggin' thing. People cheered this, though, for the most part. Goldberg crawled over to pick up the belt. He struggled to his feet. He grunted in anger. He finally took a bump. Finally took a bump. See, that wasn't so bad. See, now maybe at WrestleMania he'll take two bumps. So if the show would have ended right here, this would have been the best Raw all year. But it didn't end here. We had Gallows and Anderson against Enzo and Big Cass. Sheamus and Cesaro were out there sipping coffee. They were sipping lattes outside the ring. I think Enzo bumped into them. They spilled coffee all over themselves. Reminded me of when Jericho spilled coffee on Kane. That's how that feud started. Jericho spilled coffee on Kane and apologized for burning him and then laughed at the irony of it. And that's how the Jericho-Kane feud got started. So it's not as though every storyline going back 15, 16 years was, you know, people romanticize a lot about that era. There were some pretty stupid storylines back then too, believe me. And a lot of them involved Kane, unfortunately. So... Cesaro and Sheamus were pissed off. They got in the ring. This ended in a DQ. Whatever. They announced Ravishing Rick Rude for the WWE Hall of Fame. Well-deserved. A well-deserved induction for Ravishing Rick Rude. I've never seen anybody in wrestling take a more hilarious bump for an atomic drop than Rick Rude. I'll always remember him for a few things, but that's one of them. The only man to ever appear on Raw and Nitro in the same night simultaneously on two different channels at the same time. On one show he had a beard, on the other show he was clean-shaven. See, now that takes talent. Put him in the Hall of Fame for that alone. He's also one of the few people to score a pinfall win over the Ultimate Warrior. Rude gave Warrior, I would argue that Rude gave Warrior his best matches. I guess you could say Randy Savage did also. I think Randy Savage, Randy Savage did give the Ultimate Warrior the best match of his career, WrestleMania 7, so maybe Savage would get the slight edge. But you go back and watch that SummerSlam 89 match, I mean, even the cage match they had in 90, but especially the one in 89, I just thought that was really good. I mean, really good by the standards of an Ultimate Warrior match. I think we have to qualify these things here. Rude's work in WCW was every bit as good. Now, I wasn't following too much of it when I was a kid. Obviously, I've gone back and I've watched a lot of that 1992, 1993 WCW stuff and all those shows and the Beach Blasts and the War Games and all that kind of stuff. And he was really, he was better. As a performer, as far as being featured and the matches he was having, Rude was a step above, I think, in his WCW run than he was in WWF. He actually beat Ric Flair to become the world champion there, but unfortunately he got two major injuries. He broke his neck and he broke his back. And to break either one of those things on its own is really bad, but imagine breaking both. Now, he didn't break them at the same time, but those are two pretty significant injuries. And the broken back, I mean, I maintain the broken back was just a tragedy that did not have to happen. The way that whole thing went down. I mean, the guy, he's wrestling Sting in a match in Japan. Okay, so they're in this dome. I think somebody corrected me once. I said Tokyo Dome. I think it was like the Fukuoka Dome. But wherever it was, they're in this giant dome in Japan. They're having a match for the championship. And this would have been in 94. And Rude is standing outside the ring. Sting comes diving, and I mean diving, out over the top rope. Lands on Rude. Rude falls backwards. And on those Japanese shows, in the domes at least, they were on a raised platform. The ring was on a raised platform. I don't know if it was 3 inches, 6 inches, whatever it was. And Rude's lower back landed right on the edge of the platform. Broke his back. Somehow he managed to finish the match. I guess the adrenaline and everything was flowing. I'm sure he was feeling it when he went to the back. But he finished the match and he won. He didn't just finish the match. He won the match. He won the championship back. He never did have a chance to defend it. He had to vacate it. And that was it. He was forced into an early retirement. And he came back many years later as a bodyguard for DX in 97. I never thought he was really a good fit for DX. It was very short-lived, but it seemed weird, right? You know, it just didn't seem like a good fit. He wasn't under contract, so WCW stole him away. They put him in the NWO. Supposedly, at the time of his death, he was training to make a comeback with WWE. And then he died of, I don't think it was a heart attack. I just think it was heart failure. Officially, it was from a mix of medications they found in his system that stopped his heart. There's been a lot of rumors about Rick Rude's death. I think they've largely been spurred on by a story that the Honky Tonk Man told. Okay, you can find the clip on YouTube. I really don't want to give it any more oxygen because it's the Honky Tonk Man. Take what that guy says with a mound of salt, okay? Who the hell knows if it's true? The thing with Rude was a great wrestler. One of the all-time great heels, I think, in wrestling. Had a lot of memorable matches, a lot of friends in the business. Bret Hart thought the world of him. I know he was pretty broken up when imagine Bret Hart, my God, that whole late 90s period, his brother died. Well, he gets screwed over by WWF, which he could just never get over. Then Owen died. Then Rick Rude died. He was very close to him. Then he had to retire the year after, because Rude died in 99. Bret had to retire in 2000 from the kick to the head by Goldberg. Then he had the stroke a couple years after that. Man, I mean, has there been anybody who's had a shittier, like, 5-year period than Bret Hart? Even if you don't like Bret, you got to at least have some sympathy for the guy. But yeah, I mean, Rude had a lot of friends in the business, and supposedly that was one of the reasons he bailed on WWE the way he did in 97. He was there in Montreal. He was backstage. He saw the whole screw job go down, and he was friendly with Bret Hart, and he was not happy at all with how that whole thing went down, and so he defected to WCW. It was only like a week or two later. Had he come back to WWE in 1999, the way he had planned, it would have been interesting. I'm trying to see like where Rick Rude in 1999 Attitude Era WWE would fit in. I look back and I think it probably would have ended up with like a British Bulldog type of run. Bulldog came back in 99. Bulldog, though, was a physical wreck. He was a physical wreck. And he had his own injury in WCW where he got slammed on the trap door. It was some sort of a back or a spinal injury. Not exactly the same injury that Rude had, but kind of a similar situation. And Bulldog was never the same after that. And neither was Rude, obviously. I mean, he never wrestled. But I think he would have ended up with having a Bulldog-type run that Bulldog had in 99, and that was not a good run. I mean, Bulldog did end up in a pay-per-view match. It was like a six-pack challenge main event for the championship. I think he only got the spot because Undertaker had to leave and go have surgery, so they kind of plugged Bulldog in there. He was never going to win, obviously. But he had a singles match on pay-per-view with The Rock. That was like his big match in that run. And literally just rock-bottomed onto a pile of what was supposed to be actual dog shit. It's sad. I mean, it really is sad that that is one of the lasting final images of the British Bulldog's career, was him being rock-bottomed onto dog crap. Probably a metaphor for his run there that year. I would have hated to see Rick Rude used that way, now that I look back on that. I don't want to say, oh, it's a good thing it didn't happen. The only reason it didn't happen is because he died. I don't want to say that, but, you know, I mean, look, maybe they would have used him in the hardcore division. They kind of did that with Bulldog too. And Big Boss Man, him and Big Boss Man were very good friends. He and Kurt Hennig were like best friends. And all three of them are dead. Think about that. Boss Man is dead. Perfect is dead. Rude is dead. And it's not like they just died either. They've been dead for years. All three of them. Wrestling is, man, it is a cruel business. It really is. Ricky Steamboat is the one inducting Rude into the Hall of Fame. They feuded in WCW. They had some good matches together. Really good matches. Rude was the polar opposite of Steamboat. I think that's a big part of what made the whole Steamboat Flair thing so great. You could not find two guys here with personalities that were as, like, the polar opposite of each other. I think that's probably why they work so well together. So I think Steamboat's a great choice. New Day rode out with a bicycle and an ice cream cart I don't think it's ice cream that they're going to be selling. I read that it's going to be ice pops, which is better than ice cream. At least for me, it is. I haven't been able to eat ice cream since the Attitude Era, so I may be a bit biased in this. If I could still eat ice cream, though, and cream cheese and all that good stuff, I'd probably still be 182 right now and not 165. It has not been easy. I will say that. It has not been. Anybody's been tracking, I've been mentioning this on Twitter, because I started the whole DDP yoga thing a couple of months ago, 3 months ago. And actually, I kind of fell off that a little bit. I've only been doing that like once or twice a week. It really hasn't so much been that. It's, DDP yoga was kind of the catalyst for me to start making some changes, but it really is just, honestly, it's like extra cardio at the gym and just tracking calories in and calories out. That's really all it's been. I'd say 17 pounds in 3 months is pretty good. And I'm not done yet either. I want to go another 5. So watching New Day come out talking about ice cream every week, I just want to shake them and say, no ice cream. No ice cream. No booty-os. They should be coming down to the ring and passing out raw almonds to all the kids in the front row. It even goes with the name of the show. Raw. Right? Come on. I can't be the only one who thinks this. Raw almonds and baby carrots. That's what they should be handing out. Maybe that's how they get New Day to turn heel. When they finally open the ice cream cart, like they tease it for weeks and weeks and weeks, and when they finally open it, there's no ice cream, there's no ice pops. Instead, it's all healthy shit. I think it would be the ultimate troll job by the New Day. They honored Trish and Lita for National Women's Month. I'm already dreading the week they honor Moolah. Mick Foley was in the ring with Bayley. He congratulated her on her win at Fastlane, but Bayley said, everybody saw what Sasha Banks did. It just didn't feel right. And Sasha came out, tried to talk her way into a title match with Bayley at WrestleMania. Very heelish. I mean, Sasha is very, you know, she's very much out for herself here. She's interfering in these matches when her friend doesn't want her to. Now she's trying to coerce her into a championship match at WrestleMania. She's already turning. This is not an idea, folks. It's already happening. We're in the middle of the transformation here. I did pitch this very match for WrestleMania this year, going all the way back to last spring. I think it was about a year ago. I pitched Bayley. My whole idea for Bayley, I'm kind of, you know, bummed they screwed the whole thing up, but I pitched Bayley making her main roster debut the night after SummerSlam last year, and then you do the slow build to the eventual Bayley-Sasha match in Orlando at WrestleMania. Instead, they gave it away on this show 4 weeks before WrestleMania because they're idiots. Charlotte and Dana came out. She accused Sasha of faking her friendship with Bayley. She called herself the victim of a conspiracy. She's been watching Chris Jericho tapes from 1998 WCW. And then out came Stephanie McMahon. You know how on SNL they portray Steve Bannon as the Grim Reaper? That's sort of how I picture Stephanie whenever I hear her theme music. I picture the skeleton holding the scythe whenever I hear her theme. She was met with chants of CM Punk. She called the fans predictable and said, you're just like CM Punk. You're all losers. You know she must enjoy it. Like, whenever she sees Chicago on the itinerary as, like, the next city, she gets all giddy and she, like, spends all day planning for these moments. Unfortunately for her, it only made things worse. Not only did the crowd continue to chant for CM Punk, they were so loud I could barely make out what Stephanie was saying, which is actually great. That's a great way to mute Stephanie. Just boo her and chant CM Punk so loud you can't hear a word she says. She said Charlotte is the one who deserves a title shot, not Sasha, and she announced it would be Bayley defending against Charlotte at WrestleMania. Mick Foley piped up and said, you can't leave the boss out of WrestleMania. And Stephanie asked Foley, who's the boss? And at that moment, I thought to myself, man, they're going to get Tony Danza to come in and referee this match at WrestleMania, aren't they? They compromised by having Sasha wrestle Bayley right here on this show, and if Sasha won, if Sasha beat the champion in a non-title match here on Raw, the match at WrestleMania would become a three-way. And I hope it is. It will be a better match without Nia Jax in there. So hopefully they keep it as a triple threat. We had Sasha against Bayley here on the show. They did some chain wrestling at first. Crowd was quiet. Charlotte was on commentary. Eventually she went down to the ring for a closer view. Sasha got the bank statement locked on, but Dana Brooke distracted the referee. She did so without botching, so that's great. Charlotte tried to interfere, break up the hold. Sasha booted her out of the way, was able to roll through, got Bayley right in the middle of the ring in the bank statement. Nowhere to go. Champion tapped out. And so it will indeed be a three-way for the title at WrestleMania with Bayley basically in the Becky Lynch role from last year's show. They showed Seth Rollins in rehab, trying to get ready for WrestleMania. They interviewed Triple H via satellite. He praised WWE's great medical staff. And given they were in Chicago, the irony of that statement did not go unnoticed. Believe me, that line was no accident. You know that he and Stephanie take great pleasure in trolling you-know-who any chance they get. So he warned Rollins about coming to WrestleMania and calling him out, because if he does, it will be the last thing he ever does. And so that's how they're promoting this thing, it looks like. They're not promoting this as a match. They're promoting this as Seth Rollins calls out Triple H at WrestleMania. They had a new vignette for Emma. Enough already. You know, like, just save her. I hope this is what they're doing. Just save her for the night after WrestleMania. You know she's going to get a monster reaction that night if she actually comes out and does something. Just save her for the night after WrestleMania, debut her there, and just be done with this shit already. Just enough. Samoa Joe and Chris Jericho had a match. Now, normally I would hear that and I would think, wow, this should be really good. It wasn't. It went 3 minutes. Joe beat him by countout after choking him out on the floor. Jericho then gave him a code breaker after the match. Only good thing I can say about this, this was just to fill time. This served no purpose. It's not like, well, Joe got a dominant win over Chris Jericho, or Chris Jericho got a dominant win over Joe because he's the one with a WrestleMania match, not Joe. This is now, the only good thing I can say about this is that this is now the second Raw main event that Samoa Joe has gotten since he has debuted. I mean, the main event actually wasn't a match, it was a promo, but as far as matches go, it was the main event. Wasn't a very good one, but it was still the main event. And Joe has now been in two of them so far. One against Roman Reigns and now one against Chris Jericho. So I am happy to see that. I am happy to see that they see Samoa Joe in an upper tier role on that Raw roster. Braun Strowman came out and demanded Roman Reigns come out and face him. He was very angry about losing the night before. So were the 4,600 people who voted in our Twitter poll. They weren't very happy about that either. Yeah, it's amazing. That type of response, to get that level, that number of votes, that usually is reserved for like the really, really big shows like WrestleMania. I've had WrestleMania polls that I've posted before that have gotten 5,000 or 6,000 votes. But for like a B-show single brand pay-per-view, to have almost 5,000 votes in like a flash poll on Twitter, you know people had to be pissed off about that show. Usually, if you get that kind of response, it is a rousing reaction of some kind, and people tend to be a lot more engaged when they're really, really angry, as opposed to when they're really, really happy about something. So, yeah, I think that response speaks volumes. Roman's music began to play, but it was immediately interrupted by The Undertaker's gong. He walked out, got a great reaction. He went face-to-face with Strowman, which actually got chance of holy shit. And Strowman slowly backpedaled, and he left through the crowd. So, after doing such a good job with this guy for months, on back-to-back nights, he loses to Roman Reigns, and he backs down from The Undertaker. This had to be testing the waters for a possible match, because there was no other reason for Strowman to even be out there. They could have easily just had The Undertaker come out and interrupt Roman Reigns. There was no reason to effectively bitch out Strowman the way they did here, but they did. And Reigns did come out. He got booed. Shocking, I know. And if they think the reaction is going to be any different in Orlando, then they're out of their friggin' minds. Lots of Roman sucks chants. By the way, they edited the crowd reaction to Reigns in the video on WWE's YouTube channel. Someone did a side-by-side comparison on Twitter, and you could actually tell the difference. They muted the negative response when they were looking up at the WrestleMania sign. So, just remember, folks, they control the narrative. You don't control it. They do. Roman said Strowman didn't call you out. He called me out. All due respect, this is my yard now. Massive boos. Undertaker goozled him. I love that word. Yeah, I never heard that word before until Taz started to use it on SmackDown all those years ago. He goozled him. Gave him a choke slam. Walked out. And so it is official. It will be Roman Reigns against The Undertaker at WrestleMania. So get ready. 23-2. It's coming. Now, the more I look at things, the more it becomes very clear. Roman Reigns, he has now beaten Braun Strowman, the first person to do that. He beats The Undertaker at WrestleMania, and then he beats Brock Lesnar for the championship. Seems pretty obvious to me. They're going to have him slay all the giants. Now, I'm still pulling for Lesnar and Strowman at SummerSlam. Doesn't mean that even if they do Roman and Brock, maybe they do it, but not at SummerSlam. I still like to think that there will be a match at SummerSlam, title or not, between Strowman and Lesnar. I'm hoping. I think this scenario here seems more and more likely with each passing day. Mania Crawl 4 is coming to Orlando WrestleMania weekend. We partnered with Mania Crawl for our SummerSlam meetup last year. Probably will again in the future. They're good people. The Crawl will split time between three different bars on Wall Street Plaza in Orlando on Sunday, April 2nd, beginning at 11:30 a.m. You can go to maniacrawl.com for more details and use the Lyft code CRAWL4. That's CRAWL and the number 4. If you are in the area and you are using Lyft over Uber and anything else, so take advantage of that. SmackDown Live from Ontario. Actually, no, where was SmackDown Live? It was Ontario a few weeks ago. I don't remember where SmackDown was. Doesn't matter. People seem to like this show. 2,000 votes plus, 81% thumbs up, 19% thumbs down. They had one match in the first 60 plus minutes of this show. That is not an 81% thumbs up show. I'm sorry. I enjoyed the show overall. When it was over, I thought it was good, but not 81% good. John Cena and Nikki Bella teamed up for the first time ever. They beat Carmella and James Ellsworth after hitting stereo five-knuckle shuffles, followed by stereo STFs, and the heels tapped out. It was even more obvious watching them doing it side-by-side, how much better Nikki's STF is than Cena's. I mean, I've said this before, but to watch them side-by-side, it's like, wow. Could not be any more obvious. After the match, Miz and Maryse laid them both out, and Miz just had a banner night on the mic. He cut a promo on them. He talked about their love being fake and how robotic and emotionless John Cena is, which is true. And Maryse told Nikki, break that, bitch, and then drop the mic. Maryse is awesome. Can we talk about talking smack? Can we just skip ahead here? Miz was awesome. I know that's his gimmick and all, but he really was. He absolutely roasted John Cena on there. Again, he talked about how robotic he is, and Daniel Bryan, who, of course, is part of the family now with John, he shot back at Miz. He was kind of defending Cena. He was talking about how much of a corporate shill The Miz is, which is true. The Miz is a corporate shill. He does sound like that every time he speaks. But I'm watching this, and I'm like the back and forth and the back and forth. And I feel like in an alternate universe somewhere, Miz and Daniel Bryan would be co-headlining WrestleMania this year. Like, there's been enough heat built up between these two guys for so long now, and the promos and the jabs back and forth have been so great that I would totally buy this as a WrestleMania, maybe not the main event, but a main event. One of the big top 2-3 matches at WrestleMania. And it's a shame they're not going to do it. It really is. It still makes me wonder why the hell they're even building heat between these two. I mean, look, I guess it's just entertaining television, but it's not leading to anything. People thought it might be leading to Bryan bringing somebody like a Nakamura in to challenge Miz at WrestleMania almost like a surrogate, but obviously that's not happening. So I have no idea where this may or may not lead to in the future, but for now, it is at least very entertaining. It makes talking smack must-see TV, in my opinion, as if Renee Young wasn't, you know, enough of a reason. Now you have another reason to watch talking smack. But the biggest news coming out of this was Miz telling Bryan, yo, you want to be a wrestler, but you can't because of your head. To which Bryan replied, I can't or they won't let me. We'll see in a year and a half. Now, Bryan's contract expires in a year and a half. That's what he was referring to. It's no great secret that this guy wants to wrestle again. He is not happy that WWE will not allow him to wrestle. He loves wrestling. It's all he's ever known. It's all he's ever done. And he would do it in a heartbeat. If WWE came to him, if they called him on the phone tomorrow, even with a kid on the way, even if it is not medically advisable for him to get back in the ring and start taking shots to the head and everything else, he would drop everything and do it in a heartbeat. I have no doubt about that at all. And it is no secret that the belief is that when his contract is up, he will leave WWE and he will go wrestle somewhere else. Now, as long as he's on TV, he technically is working. But let's say Brie gives birth. And by the way, they announced the name of their, it has to be a daughter, I guess. They announced the name of their child this week. I believe Birdie Joe Danielson, I believe is the name they picked. I don't want to be mean, so we'll move on from that. But the point I'm trying to make is, let's say Brie gives birth. They take Brian off television for a while, right? No doubt, WWE is going to claim that, well, this extends his contract. As long as he's not, like, actively working and he's not on television performing and doing stuff for us, his contract is essentially frozen, right? That's what they would argue, because they've done this before. They pulled this nonsense with Rey Mysterio. So I'm not sure WWE is going to willingly let him walk after 18 months. If he thinks he's just going to walk out the front door, he may be in for a rude awakening. Because, you know, WWE doesn't want him walking out to TNA or Ring of Honor, you know, the next day. They don't want that. Especially if it is somebody who they're giving television time to on their network and on their shows every single week. He may be in for a fight if he thinks it's going to be that easy to walk out. And he's got to be very careful because, you know, his wife, you know, Brie has talked about wanting to go back and wrestle after she gives birth, and Nikki obviously is with the company, and so it's not just him. He's got to worry about his wife, and he's got to worry about his family, and what effect that might have if he gets into some big fight with WWE. I still feel bad for AJ Lee. You know, she was kind of caught in the middle of everything. AJ Lee is another one who had this great story of being a big wrestling fan. It's all she ever wanted to do, and she worked through all these obstacles in her life to become women's champion. You know that AJ didn't want to just retire and walk away when she was, you know, 25 years old. She'd still be there now. She missed that whole era with, like, Charlotte and Sasha and Becky and Bayley, and you know that AJ would love to be in the middle of that. But how could she be? Look what happened, you know, her and her husband. I mean, look, the good thing is she met her husband working for WWE. The bad thing is her husband and WWE don't like each other. And so it made for this untenable situation, and she had to leave. But it affected her. And you gotta be mindful of that sort of thing, because when there's family involved and you're kind of caught in the middle, that's a pretty shitty situation to find yourself in. So I suspect they'll try to keep him under contract as long as he can. I guess the question is, are you comfortable, like, as a fan? Because you guys know I'm a big fan of Daniel Bryan. Are you comfortable knowing this guy's concussion issues? Are you comfortable with him wrestling again? How does that make you feel as a fan? I mean, would you cringe? Would you not care? I think if he finds, let's say, 5 different doctors telling him that you're fine, you can wrestle, we'll clear you, then more power to him. Then he should wrestle as much as he wants. But see, supposedly, he has a lesion on his brain. He has a lesion on his brain. That is terrifying. He's got a kid on the way. I don't think it's worth it. I think he's had a hell of a career for himself, and there's a lot of other things he could be doing. But at the end of the day, it's his life, and it's his health, and the guy should be able to do whatever he wants. And if WWE will not let him do that, then he should be free to go do what he wants somewhere else. And as far as WWE goes with all the medical stuff here and not letting him wrestle, look, I get their position, and they are well within their rights to not want to take a risk on the guy. Knowing what they know. God forbid something happens. WWE is in deep shit because they've had their doctors look at this guy's scans and they kept him out of the ring for so long because they didn't feel it was safe for him to get back in. If all of a sudden they let him back in and something happens, I mean, they're fucked. So I totally get their, they've already made up their mind. They've dug in their heels. They can't now turn around and say, okay, we change our minds. We'll let you wrestle again. They can't do that. As a company, you can't do that. They've already made their decision. That's it. I get that. But I think Brian is going to leave. I think he's going to leave, and I think he's going to make his way around the indies. I don't think he's going to commit to just one promotion. I mean, I would liken it. I kind of liken it to what Cody Rhodes has been doing. I think Brian will end up doing the same thing. I just hope, you know, that he does the right thing and gets himself checked out beforehand to make sure everything is okay. And, you know, maybe he knows stuff. Look, it's his medical records. Obviously, you know, there's stuff in there that we're not privy to. But having a lesion on your brain sounds like a pretty serious thing. And, if he does wrestle again, I hope that he makes changes up, you know, changes to his style and cuts out the diving headbutts and the suicide dives and just, you know, adopts a different style. Guys have done that before. Steve Austin got dropped on his neck. Got dropped on his head and had to change his entire style and basically become a brawler. And that worked for him. Guys get older, they have to adjust. So hopefully he can do the same. Speaking of Miz, before I forget, WWE posted another great video on their YouTube channel. It's called My Son is a WWE Superstar. It's with Miz's parents. So yes, Miz's dad is the total star of this video. And they talk about the time that Miz's dad got caught smiling on television in the front row as Randy Orton was like beating the piss out of Miz right in front of him. Oh, I remember loving that so much when I reviewed that on the podcast. You know you've made it when you get your own Titantron. If you go on YouTube, he's got his own. I just love the fact that Miz's dad has his own Titantron. But then again, David Flair also has his own Titantron. So the bar has been set very low. Backstage, Baron Corbin tried to murder Dean Ambrose by commandeering a forklift and lowering a pallet onto Dean's chest, trapping him underneath. Ambrose was taken to a local medical facility, not one of those stupid hospitals. And we were told he was coughing up blood. He'll walk it off. He'll be fine. Alexa Bliss came out to give her blissertation. This was pretty bad. She basically was just telling off all of the different women and all the reasons why I'm not defending my title against you at WrestleMania. I'm not defending against you. Mickie James was very upset when she found out that Alexa wasn't defending against her either. Daniel Bryan came out and said, you're going to have to defend your championship at WrestleMania against every available woman on the SmackDown roster. Now, he didn't explain if that meant a gauntlet match. He didn't explain if that meant a battle royal or what. They didn't say. I assume it means the return of Eva Marie at WrestleMania. She's been gone for many, many months. I certainly hope they don't put the title on her, but would not be shocked. And Naomi. And I actually think this is a more likely scenario. If Naomi can make it back, it's kind of like Rollins. If Naomi can make it back in time from her injury for WrestleMania, she can go into Orlando. It's her hometown. She can make the valiant comeback and win the championship back, and it could be a nice big feel-good moment. So, but that's completely predicated on her getting well. If she can, I think that's probably how it all goes down at WrestleMania. They gave nearly 20 minutes to Randy Orton and AJ Styles in the main event to decide who will challenge Bray Wyatt for the WWE title at WrestleMania. This was good. This was not great. I know these two can have a great match. This was not that match. So hopefully they're just saving it for a pay-per-view. I think it's kind of crazy they gave this away on TV anyway. I wish they would have saved it for a pay-per-view anyway, but this was good. It was missing that little something extra to make it special and to make it memorable. The finish was great though. AJ was setting up for the phenomenal forearm. Randy Orton went for the RKO because basically Styles faked him out. He went to go for it, but he held on. And Orton went for the RKO. He ended up falling flat on his back. And AJ followed through, went for a springboard 450, but Orton avoided it, and Orton then hit the RKO for the pin. Randy Orton will challenge Bray Wyatt at WrestleMania. AJ Styles screwed out of the WrestleMania main event. They shot the angle after the show, put it up on YouTube. They aired it on Talking Smack, too. I did like the way they did that. They kind of cut in. Oh, we have breaking news. There was like a brawl in the back, and they cut to the back, and we see AJ in the gorilla position, and he got into a pull-apart brawl with Shane McMahon, and they're doing something with those two today at Madison Square Garden. Probably as I'm recording this, the show starts in a few hours. I think it's a Raw live event, but they added AJ and Shane, not in a match, but they added them to the lineup. So we'll see if they shoot an angle maybe at the Garden today, and then they show footage on SmackDown on Tuesday. Look, let's look at the bright side of this, okay? It gets AJ Styles in a high-profile match at WrestleMania. Shane McMahon is still very popular. It is not the worst spot. I had one person write, oh, it's the worst match of all time. Like, get the hell out of here. This is not the worst match of all time. And frankly, I think these two will probably go in there and they'll surprise a lot of people. But it is not the worst spot for AJ to be in. I could think of five other spots on that card that he could be in that would be a lot worse. But it's not the best. And I think that's why a lot of people are very upset. AJ Styles is arguably the best wrestler on the planet right now. They have a lot of talent on that roster, on the main roster, NXT. And here we are now on the biggest show of the year. You would like to see them set up some sort of story going into it with AJ and someone else on his level. So that at WrestleMania, right, their biggest show of the year, it all comes to a head and the two of them go out there and they have a classic. Now, if they make it a street fight, Shane's had two pretty classic street fights before. He had one against Kurt Angle and he had one against his father at WrestleMania. That was the one where zombie Linda rose from the chair and kicked Vince in the crotch. That was a fun match. And I think this can be too, but this is the best that they could come up with. I think the fact that this is the best they could come up with for AJ Styles is still an indictment on WWE. That this is the best idea they had for him, I think, just doesn't speak well to their planning for this year's WrestleMania.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week was taped from the University of Central Florida. I feel like I was in that building last year. They might have done a TV taping, I think maybe over Royal Rumble week. I vaguely remember being there. Ty Dillinger and Eric Young never got started because the other members of Sanity dragged Roderick Strong's dead body out on stage. He was badly beaten. Man, has there been a pickup from ROH with less buzz around them than Roderick Strong? I sometimes forget he's even on the roster. It's kind of why I think it would be better if Kyle O'Reilly... I don't know what's going on with Kyle O'Reilly. There were rumors he was coming to NXT, but I almost think it would be better if he doesn't. I just don't see him as being this great big, you know, difference maker there. It might actually be better for him to go somewhere else, but... Dillinger opted to go check on his friend rather than fight EY. No way Jose came out to check on Roddy. The building was silent as this was going on, like Japanese crowd silent. It was very eerie. Jose and Dillinger ran down to the ring to fight off Sanity, but they were outnumbered and beaten down. I really don't much care for this storyline, to be honest with you. I never could get into Eric Young in TNA, and I can't get into him now. Nothing has changed. This is a great role for him to be in, and I like, you know, like Killian Dane. The former Big Damo, I think, has a lot of potential in terms of what they do with him. But just EY just does nothing for me. We got a pre-taped video from Billy Kay and Peyton Royce filming each other walking around the Performance Center trying to find a place to put their Breakout Star of the Year award. I guess they did fan voting for a bunch of awards at the end of last year and they won. This is actually kind of funny. So they see Ember Moon through the glass working out with one of the trainers in the other rooms, and they start mocking her. And Ember sees them, and she makes a beeline out of the room, and you can hear Peyton, I think it was Peyton, she was holding the camera, basically going like, uh-oh, she's coming out! And the trainer's holding back Ember Moon, and anyway, this led to a match later in the show between Ember Moon and Billy Kay. Ember won with the Eclipse off the top. Billy sold a neck injury after the match. They played this up like a big injury angle, which is all that it was. She laid there for a long time. The referees and the trainers were out there hovering over her. At no point did it come across to me as a legit injury. Some people bought into it as a legit thing, so I guess, you know, mission accomplished. But she's fine. And look, if nothing else, when WWE.com put a story up asking, oh, should the Eclipse be banned because of what happened here? I mean, if that's not a dead giveaway, then, I mean, come on, people. So, you know, the announcers also, they were playing the move up is very dangerous. So all of a sudden, this kind of came out of nowhere because she's been using this move for months. And it looks really cool and devastating. But it's not like it's put anybody out. It's not like the announcers have ever made mention of it being this dangerous move that should be banned. So somewhere they made the decision to really play this move up like a big deal. And that's great. Good. They should do that more often with their big moves, instead of everybody kicking out of finishers left and right. William Regal later on announced that Ember Moon would challenge Asuka for the NXT Championship at TakeOver Orlando, so that match is official. By the way, big signing or potential signing for WWE was reported in the Wrestling Observer this week. I don't know if she's put pen to paper yet, but Kairi Hojo from the Stardom promotion in Japan is on her way in. Said to be a 3-year deal. Nakamura has apparently been pushing very hard for her to come in for months now. If you recall, she was one of the 3 Japanese wrestlers who wrestled Pentagon Dark on Lucha Underground in that gauntlet match. She has an insanely awesome-looking elbow drop off the top rope that would make Randy Savage snap 10 Slim Jims if he were still alive. She's considered one of the best female workers in the world right now. She is a double title holder at the moment in Stardom. And I kind of feel bad for Stardom here because she's really screwing them over. She had expressed interest in going to WWE months ago. I think I even talked about it on the podcast. There were 3 of them who were going to be coming in. And they all decided against that. They were going to stay with Stardom. They wanted to help take Stardom to the next level. And this was like the end of last year. This wasn't that long ago. So she wins these championships and they kind of build around her. And now she turns around and says, I'm leaving for WWE after all. See ya. But, you know, hey, that's how it goes. WWE can be very appealing, and when they come knocking, it's very hard not to answer that door. A lot of promotions, I think, are finding that out these days. It's only going to get worse. So they aired a vignette for Tommy End, who is debuting soon. Aleister Black will be his new name. It's kind of had like a gothic feel to it. Lots of candles and that sort of thing. Andrade Cien Almas beat Hojo Loon with the Hammerlock DDT. Well, he's got a cool finish. It's the best I can say. Cassius Ohno challenges Bobby Roode for the NXT Championship on next week's show, which is this week's show, if you're listening to this. He did a sit-down interview inside the Performance Center with the face that fucks the place, Tom Phillips. He talked about how weird it was, you know, felt being back after all these years, and he can remember when the Performance Center was just an empty warehouse. He vowed to win the title and defended a TakeOver in Orlando. We then went to Bobby Roode via satellite from his home, quote-unquote. He said the NXT champion should not be some long-haired hippie hobo from the 70s. The future of NXT lies with him, and he'll be damned if he's going to let someone like Ohno ruin that. I'd be more pissed about the fact that Ohno is getting an NXT title shot in his very first match. He ought to ask William Regal about that. Better yet, get Samoa Joe to do it, just so we can hear him scream Regal's name again. I miss that. TJ Perkins against Shinsuke Nakamura, the returning Shinsuke Nakamura here in the main event. First time seeing both guys in an NXT ring in quite a while. Very good main event. Perkins dabbed in the middle of the match and got booed, which is good. Instant heel whenever he does that. Nakamura dabbed, but it just seemed a little less douchey when he did it. Perkins worked over Nakamura's knee to play off the storyline injury. They played up the fact that, you know, his big move is the knee bar, and Nakamura has to try to avoid it. So there were some pretty cool reversals here out of different holds. Perkins did get the knee bar on. Nakamura made the ropes, he made his big comeback, hit the Kinshasa, got the pin. If you watch one thing on this show, make it this match. This was good stuff. And we'll find out this Wednesday who his opponent will be at TakeOver in Orlando. I didn't read the spoilers on that. I'm kind of pulling for a triple threat myself. But we'll see. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Chris from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who apologized in his email to me on behalf of his hometown for that shitty Raw crowd from a few weeks ago. Apology accepted. He says, one of my all-time favorite feuds is Jake the Snake Roberts versus Ravishing Rick Rude. With Rude finally going into the Hall of Fame, what do you think was his best feud, his best match, and the best year of his career? I think the best year of his career was 1992. I was just talking about this earlier when I mentioned Rude going into the Hall of Fame and how, yeah, obviously I grew up a WWF fan and I remember him vividly from his run there and I knew he was in WCW. I watched a little bit of WCW, but not a lot. Only in the last, 10 years or whatever, I've been able to go back and watch a lot of that 1992, 1993 WCW stuff. And Rude was great in 92. WWE did not, they did not use him to his full potential, but I thought 92 was probably his best year. His best match was the War Games match from that year. It was Sting's Squadron against the Dangerous Alliance. In fact, that was one of the matches on that countdown that I did last year on the top 15 greatest matches in WCW history. As far as his best feud, it's got to be Jake, I would think. It's got to be Jake the Snake Roberts. And again, and you guys have heard me heap praise on the Macho Man Jake the Snake angle. You know that's one of my favorites, if not my favorite. One of the reasons for that was it was something serious. It was personal. It was serious in an era where it was very much a cartoon. And you just did not see a lot of serious shit in WWE back then. I mean, you did in the NWA and all these other promotions, but not in WWE. And here again, we have another angle involving Jake Roberts that's more serious and more personal. Rick Rude used to pick women out of the crowd to come in. He would kiss them and they would fall at his feet. He tried to pick a woman out of the crowd. She refused. It turned out to be Jake's wife, his actual wife, Cheryl, and they ended up feuding. If you want real heel heat, you do what Rick Rude did. You airbrush your opponent's wife's face onto your crotch. Easy way to get heel heat. But that was the second really, serious personal feud that Jake was involved in that was really, really good. I mean, Jake just had a knack for those things. I mean, it was the nature of his character. He was a creepy dude. Jake was not a cartoon character. He was the real deal. He was not a guy that you wanted to mess with. Joey from Washington, D.C., do you think WWE could do AJ Styles against Finn Balor for brand supremacy at WrestleMania? Would this be a better idea than AJ against Shane McMahon? Yeah, it would. It really would. Balor, by the way, just came back this weekend. He's back. He came back on the house show, so he's all ready to go. And it would be very easy to set it up. You still have a few weeks to go before WrestleMania. You know, AJ obviously is pissed off about being screwed out of the WrestleMania main event. Shane and Brian offer him a consolation prize of sorts, which is battling for SmackDown, on behalf of SmackDown against the evil Raw brand. And Balor can make his surprise return on Raw on the next... He could do it tomorrow night. You don't even have to wait a few weeks. You could do it tomorrow night. He could come back and you have each of them show up on the other show over the next few weeks and they go out there at WrestleMania and they tear the house down. And look, if you want to not just have a match, but you want to work a story out of this thing, it's very easy to do. Right? You can almost do a double turn of sorts. And I know people already cheer for it. I mean, AJ's basically a babyface already. They just haven't figured it out yet. Gets cheered everywhere he goes. So it's kind of hard to call it a double turn, but you have Anderson and Gallows show up, right? Who are they? They're there to help. AJ assumes it's him, and then, bam, they help Balor. Balor wins, because I don't think Balor should come back and lose his first big match. And that sets up a new faction on Raw, and you've successfully turned AJ. AJ now is officially, in babyface mode, and he should be already anyway. And now coming out of WrestleMania, you got a couple of options. Either he could challenge for the championship on SmackDown, or if they do a draft, AJ could get drafted to Raw and you can continue the feud on Raw with Balor and Styles. And they can have some rematches. I'm just spitballing here. If Raw does get Balor and AJ on the same brand. I don't know who SmackDown gets. I don't want to gut SmackDown. I'm very hesitant to do that. SmackDown is light years ahead of Raw. I don't want to ruin that. I do want to elevate Raw. I don't think we need to live in a world where Raw sucks and SmackDown is, in, you know, always the better show. Wouldn't it be nice if you kind of got them back on an even playing field? So I'm always kind of interested in different ways that we could strengthen Raw, and that may be one way to do it. You know, they get Balor back, they move AJ over to Raw. You'd have to call somebody up like Nakamura, though. You've got to fill that gap somehow. AJ would be a big, big loss for SmackDown. So calling up Nakamura, it would take more than that, though. You'd have to trade, you know, maybe Sami Zayn. I think Sami Zayn would be much better off, frankly, if you went to SmackDown, because it just feels like he's doomed on that Raw brand. Or maybe trade Joe. You know, Samoa Joe. I know he just signed a contract for Raw, but you could move Samoa Joe over to the SmackDown brand. So these are just different ideas to kind of investigate. But if you're asking me, would Styles Balor be a more compelling match for WrestleMania? The answer is a resounding yes, it would. Vineet from Mumbai, India. Do you think CM Punk or Batista could move the needle for Impact? And do you ever see a Hogan-like situation emerging for John Cena, where he has a falling out with Vince McMahon due to being downgraded from main events and moving to TNA? On Cena, absolutely 100% no. Not in a million years. Not in a billion years. That ain't happening. Batista, I don't think would move the needle much at all. Punk, though, is a different story. Especially now. Apparently it's popular again to start chanting CM Punk at WWE events. Thanks to The Rock and Stephanie McMahon. They were in Chicago. You knew as soon as she walked out there, you knew she was going to get showered in CM Punk chants. There are still clearly a lot of fans out there clamoring for CM Punk to come back to wrestling. And if he showed up on a live Impact with a live microphone, and let's say he even brings AJ with him, she comes in with him, okay? Then yeah, I think at least for a few weeks, that would move the needle for them quite a bit. I think there would be a lot of interest in seeing, oh, what's going to happen here? The key, though, is in the follow-up, right? It's always that way. Key is in the follow-up. What else does Impact have that is compelling enough to keep people watching beyond just CM Punk? Or is CM Punk, you know, coming out and cutting promos every week enough? Because after a while, that's going to get real old real fast, unless he's got someone to feud with. CM Punk against EC3 or CM Punk against Lashley ain't going to do it. Punk against Alberto, because now they have Alberto El Patron. That's an interesting one, and it's interesting for one reason. Because as a feud, as a match, just Punk against Alberto, besides the fact we've seen it before, and it wasn't really particularly good the first time, that does nothing. That will not turn Impact's fortunes around. But imagine, if you would, Paige is finally free from her WWE contract. Somehow she gets out of it or whatever. She comes to Impact with Alberto, and they do Punk, AJ Lee, Alberto and Paige, some kind of a program involving those four. That, I think, could get some new people watching that show. But they still have to have other compelling things on the show to keep people interested in what, you know, Impact is offering. And if they could somehow pull that off, then yeah, I think that maybe that can move the needle. But, you know, again, it's all pie in the sky. If Punk comes back to wrestling, people ask me, is CM Punk ever going to go in the WWE Hall of Fame? And I do think one day he'll end up in the Hall of Fame. I don't think we're going to see CM Punk back in a ring for WWE. I think there's too much animosity there. Obviously, the lawsuit is still, that whole thing is still going on. But I look at it as, you know, Vince has made up with so many people before. But if this goes on long enough, you know, you may be in a situation where Vince is out of the picture, or Triple H and Stephanie get even more power. That's where the real hatred is. I don't think that Vince McMahon would have any issue, you know, putting business before personal bullshit and making up with Punk. But Triple H and Stephanie, they hate CM Punk. And CM Punk has no love lost for either one of them. And unfortunately for him, if he ever wanted to come back, they're the power brokers. They're the ones that are going to really be in power as time goes on in that company. And so that's why I really just don't see a path for him to come back and make like an in-ring return. Hall of Fame, yeah, eventually it'll happen. But, you know, if he were to come back to wrestling, and I do think he will, that's the other thing. So not in a WWE ring, but I do see CM Punk wrestling again. Maybe not full time, but I don't think we've seen the last CM Punk match. Not at all. Not at all. But if he comes back, he ain't going to Impact. Punk is the kind of guy, like, I can see, and I'm not talking about it like I know him personally, but like just knowing what I know of Punk and hearing other people that do know him and have talked to him and all of that kind of stuff, I look at him and I say to myself, this is a guy who I could see just randomly showing up at a Ring of Honor show or a PWG show or like an AIW, you know, independent show, some kind of indie like near Chicago or something like that. That's the kind of thing I could see Punk doing. Whatever he thinks is fun, he'll just show up and he'll do whatever he wants to do and not be bound by WWE or TNA's bullshit. Nick from Boston, a couple of weeks ago you talked about how Bayley winning the women's championship this early was a mistake and that it should have been a much slower build. My question is, what storyline do you think they pulled the trigger on way too quickly that could have been a big draw? Okay, so he's saying going back like in history, what storyline did they kind of pull the trigger on too quickly? The invasion. I mean, I'll keep saying that until the day I die, the invasion. They should have waited a little bit longer until they were able to get Hogan and Bischoff and Flair and Goldberg and, I mean, at least some of those guys, and then have them invade. I mean, look, think about this. Within a year of WCW going under, less than a year, not even a full year, they had Booker, DDP, Flair, Hogan, Hall, and Nash. They had them anyway. Now, Bischoff came in a few months after that, but that's all you need. Then after that, maybe Sting eventually comes in. Steiner, he eventually came in. They don't all have to come in at once. That would have been money had they been a little more patient. That would have been incredible. Mike from the Bronx. I got to mention this. Mike has been a listener of this podcast from the very first episode I ever did. And he was also the first man to ever leave me a review in iTunes. And I never forgot that. So I want to say thank you to him. He says, my question pertains to Chris Jericho. Over the years, I've heard you praise Jericho for constantly reinventing himself, especially in 08 and 2016. However, most of those times it was as a heel. As great of a heel as Jericho is, has he ever really been a truly great babyface? I know he was super over in his debut, but all of the great Jericho moments I can recall since then are of him as a heel. I just made this point earlier. You and I are on the same wavelength. I agree. Jericho was super over in WWE at different points as a babyface. But if you look at the body of his career, all of his great moments and all of his memorable moments and most of those matches, they came as a heel. All the programs and the storylines and all that kind of stuff, from the conspiracy theory in WCW to the stuff in 08 with Shawn Michaels to the best friends with Kevin Owens and the stuff with him and Christian. I found them entertaining when they were a tag team. Like, All of that stuff was Jericho as a heel. It was not, like, Jericho has a very short life as a babyface because I think he just gets too obnoxious and he kind of fades after a few months. And now they finally pulled the trigger. He's officially a babyface now. The list is still very over. I think he'll be okay. Now, Jericho's leaving after WrestleMania, so he's going to be gone. It may only be for a couple of months. It may not be for that long. That's going to help him. I think, you know, turning Jericho, but then him going away and coming back, that probably is the best thing for him in terms of his longevity as a babyface. I think if he sticks around for too long, it's going to get old. So the best thing for him might be to then leave and come back and then leave and come back. And then eventually, you know, he's going to go heel again. It's inevitable. But I'm with you 100%. I never really saw Jericho as being this great babyface. To me, he's always been much more entertaining as a heel. Gabriel says, I was wondering if you've watched the wrestling documentary on Netflix called Lucha Mexico. I just watched it, and it's really good. It opened my eyes on how different wrestling is treated and seen in the States as opposed to Mexico. I highly recommend it. I have not. I have not seen it. I was invited to a screening when the movie first came out. I did not go. You are the first person who's emailed me about it. So if anybody else has seen it, I'd love to hear what you thought of it. Iceman from Philly I was a big Tito Santana fan back in the 80s. I recently read his Wikipedia and saw that Santana claims he was once being considered for a run with the WWF Championship, but the spot was given to Bret Hart. The WWF was considering expanding into Central and South America and felt that having Tito, its most high-profile Latino wrestler, as champion would aid its cause. The plan was eventually scrapped, and the decision was made to expand into Canada, thus making the Canadian-born Bret Hart a more viable option as champion. Would you happen to know anything about this? Also, how would this have affected the company at the time? I don't think it would have done the company any favors, having Tito Santana as their champion. I think there is truth to what you're saying. I've mentioned before, and Bret Hart has talked about this, that there was a list. And it wasn't the list of Jericho, it was the list of Vince. And they had a list, this was in the fall of 92, of five or six guys that they were considering for the championship, because they were going to get the title off of Ric Flair. And I don't know what the names on that list were, but Tito's name has always been rumored as being on that list. It was obviously Bret was on there, and Tito. There might have been, I'm trying to think who else. I think Undertaker was probably on that list, but Tito was supposedly on that list. So it is accurate to say that Tito was at least considered. I don't know how seriously he was considered. I never heard about them having plans to expand into Central America. I don't know where that came from. But yeah, it's true. He was at least under some kind of consideration to become WWF champion. I don't think it would have worked out very well for them. Tito Santana was a really good wrestler. I like Tito, but he's not a world champion. I just don't think it would have worked. It just would not. Again, it's a case where we see this now, where you have a guy who for so long is at a certain level. And when you try to, after all these years and all this time, all of a sudden, hey, you gotta buy into this guy as like a top guy or buy into him as a champion. It's very hard, I think, for people to kind of embrace that. And I know he was a big star and he was the Intercontinental Champion way back when. But for many, many years in that Hulkamania era, Tito, I don't want to call him a jobber. That's not really fair. He was, you know, a classic mid-card guy on the roster. He's very popular. Little trivia note, he is, I believe, the first person to ever cleanly pin The Undertaker. It was at a show, I think it was in Barcelona, and you should actually look for that clip of the pinfall on YouTube, because Tito was a huge star to some people in certain markets, and when he pinned The Undertaker, that crowd exploded. So maybe I'm not really even giving him enough credit, maybe I should be giving him some more. Tito was used as a mid-card guy. Putting the world title on him, I don't think would have really worked out very well for them at all. I think Bret was the right choice, and I think things worked out the way that they should have worked out. Cliff from Selden, New York. You know, I live in New York, and I didn't even know there was a Selden, New York. In your opinion, who was the WWE's MVP in 1992? Randy Savage, Ric Flair, or Bret Hart? That is a damn good question. Wow. That's a great question. You know, there's no easy answer. I mean, man, when I think of 92, those are the three names that pop up to me as far as the big stars they kind of built around. I mean, let's break this down, okay? Randy Savage. Randy Savage, when that year started, was in the middle of a hot feud with Jake the Snake Roberts. And it ended quickly. By the next month it was over. Prematurely, I think. But that's how his year started. Then he ends up winning the championship from Flair at WrestleMania. Held that title for most of the year. Defended it against the Warrior at SummerSlam at Wembley. Was in a feature match, actually the feature match, at Survivor Series, even though Bret headlined against Shawn Michaels, make no mistake, the featured match on that show, the real main event as they promoted it, was Randy Savage and the Ultimate Warrior against Ric Flair and Razor Ramon, which then turned into Ric Flair and Razor Ramon against Mr. Perfect and Randy Savage when the Warrior got fired. The thing with Savage is he became even more important to the company when Hogan left, because he was kind of, I don't want to call him a relic, but he was kind of the last big babyface from that Hulkamania era that they still had, or the next one in the pecking order, I guess you would say, because he was always, you know, positioned at a level below Hogan. So they relied on him even more with Hogan gone to kind of be their big top babyface. So you know, in the context of the question, you know, who's the MVP? There's definitely a case to be made for Randy Savage. Absolutely. Now with Flair, I think back to 92, I think, you know, in WWF, I immediately think of Ric Flair. I immediately think of Ric Flair because A, it was the only full year he had in that company in that first era before he came back many, many years later. But I think of the Royal Rumble, which is the best Rumble they ever did, him winning the championship in the Rumble match. It's one of those great moments in history. So that was a big, big deal. And they gave him a big push right out of the gate, clearly. So I think of him, you know, winning that Rumble. I think of him going into WrestleMania, his very first WrestleMania, walking in as the champion. I was a big fan of the whole "she was mine before she was yours" stuff with Savage. But I think, you know, if anything, I think Flair was underutilized for much of that year. I mean, if you look at what they did with him in the middle, like the meat of that year. And it's also incredible for me to think, first of all, he didn't even have a match at SummerSlam. 80,000 fans, their biggest show of the year, and Ric Flair made a run-in on the card. That was it. But it's amazing that in that entire first run in WWE, Flair had one singles match on pay-per-view. That's it. He had one. Now, I know they had a lot less pay-per-views back then. I mean, now they have 20. I mean, back then they had four. I get that. But one? He won the Rumble. He wrestled Savage. He didn't wrestle at all at SummerSlam. And then he had a tag team match at Survivor Series. And then in 93, he was in the Rumble again. And then he was gone. One singles match for a man who made his career off of big emotional singles matches against Harley and Dusty and Flair and Funk and all these different people and Steamboat. One singles match. You're going to tell me they didn't underutilize this guy? I mean, I understand the emphasis back then in WWF wasn't, you know, work rate the way it was maybe in the NWA. Forget work rate. I mean, just forget that for a second. Just to have that big storyline feud with someone that he could really kind of, you know, sink his teeth into. He did with Savage, but that was it. That's the only thing they gave him that entire year. And I feel like had Roddy Piper not disappeared after WrestleMania because, you know, he lost the Intercontinental to Bret and then he disappeared. Had he stuck around, and maybe had they kept the title on Flair, they could have feuded Flair and Piper on TV, and they could have maybe even built to a match between Flair and Piper at SummerSlam. I mean, they were already feuding. We just never got a TV match between them. The only matches they had, it was like Coliseum video stuff or house show stuff, you know, at MSG. Same thing they did with Flair and Hogan. They did have matches, just not on TV. So Flair, very important player that year, no doubt about it. But if anything, I think he was kind of undervalued. I don't think he was used enough in that, you know, in that role. And then you have Bret Hart. And Bret Hart, it's interesting because you could take the first half, or almost half, of Flair's year and take the second half of Bret's year and put them together. Like, if you merge the two, there's your answer. The answer is basically Ric Hart, okay? Like Bret Flair. That's the answer. In a perfect world, if you kind of merge the two of them together. Because Bret Hart was still just a mid-card guy at the beginning of the year. He had a great match at WrestleMania with Roddy Piper. He won back the Intercontinental title. And the Intercontinental Championship was still looked at as, like, the workhorse title. And you had to be a valuable part of that company to be in that role. Very true, but he was still just a mid-card guy. And then as the year went on, you got to the summertime, things changed, right? Things change. After the match with Piper at WrestleMania 8, what happens next? They go to Wembley Stadium in London, England. And Bret Hart is in the main event. Now, it was because of Bulldog, but still, he's in the main event of SummerSlam in front of, like, legit, at least at the time, legit the biggest crowd in the history of that company. Then he wins the championship from Flair. Then he technically, even if it wasn't the actual, pushed main event, he goes on to main event Survivor Series. So he, I mean, think about this. Bret Hart was a tag team guy. Then he got a singles push and he was IC. And Bret, in his own words, Bret says he never thought he'd get above IC. He was happy enough to be the Intercontinental Champion. He never thought he'd get above that level. He never thought he would have the chance. And all of a sudden, this guy, this tag team guy, headlines back-to-back pay-per-views. They only had 4 pay-per-views a year back then. He headlined SummerSlam and Survivor Series in championship matches. And in the middle of all this, at a house show, he beats Ric Flair and wins the world title. So they were all in. That last half, the last several months of 92, they went all in on Bret Hart. So it's hard to choose. I mean, you really can't go wrong with any of those three. I think there's an argument to be made, honestly, for each one of them. If I had to choose, I would pick Bret. Bret Hart would be my pick as the MVP for that company in 1992. But you would not be wrong if you said Flair. You would not be wrong if you said Randy Savage. Adam from Michigan, buy or sell on the better WWF career heel, Ravishing Rick Rude or the Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase? Ah, you're gonna make me pick someone other than Rude. I mean, I was talking all this great stuff about Rick Rude, and now I have to go against him. DiBiase, buy on DiBiase. Look, DiBiase kicked the basketball away from a kid, for crying out loud. He made a kid cry. There's no better way to become a heel than to make a kid cry. That's what made heel Doink so great. There were kids that cried. He would give him a balloon and then pop the balloon. I shouldn't laugh, but it's funny. Anyway, DiBiase was definitely the better heel in WWF. Absolutely. But got to buy on him. We'll do one more here. Dominic from Los Angeles, buy or sell on which version of Sid you prefer? Sid Vicious, Sid Justice, or Psycho Sid? I prefer no Sid on my TV, but if I had to pick one, which version of Sid? Psycho Sid. Psycho Sid was the best. Psycho Sid had his best matches against Shawn Michaels. And Sid, you know, I have to say this. I have to give Sid credit here, because in 1996, when he came back for the third time to that company, so he was there in 91, he left in 92, he came back in 95, he left again. Sid came back in 96 when they suspended the Warrior, okay, for no showing a bunch of events. Sid was over like a rock star, man. He was getting rock star reactions from these crowds. Like, it was amazing to go back and watch. Especially heading into the Survivor Series, the reactions that this guy was getting, the people loved him. He was over. And so that to me, and of course, over as he was, he beat Shawn Michaels and he won the world championship. So there you go. Best run of his career easily was Psycho Sid. All right, this week in Sound Off History, we go back in the vault here on episode 486, all the way back to episode 86 from October 17, 2009. I led with news of Shane McMahon quitting WWE. So here we are almost 8 years later. Shane is back on TV. He's working with them again. He's going to wrestle at WrestleMania. But back then, his resignation came out of nowhere. Came as a complete shock to a lot of people. So episode 86 covered that story and had my thoughts on the whole thing. Episode 186 from October 22nd, 2011, raved about CM Punk versus Dean Ambrose in FCW. That was when Punk made a pit stop down there. He had a match against Ambrose. Ambrose had not yet debuted on the main roster. Also had thoughts on a horrible ending to the TNA Bound for Glory pay-per-view. The Hogan versus Sting Philly Miracle, as some people were calling it. And my thoughts on the ESPN piece that they did on Scott Hall. Episode 286 from August 3rd, 2013, discussed Kurt Angle's latest arrest and trip to rehab. Randy Orton getting attacked by a fan in South Africa. Yeah, I remember that. That was nuts. That was so egregious. That's a good word for it. Egregious that something like that could happen. That guy could have had a knife. He could have knifed Orton. Somehow he got in the ring. Thank God nothing bad happened. But I remember how scary that was. That was scary. Also had my recap of Total Divas. This had to have been the very first episode. I only watched three of them. So I think I watched the first three episodes they ever did. So my guess is that this was probably my review of the very first episode. Let's see. Tito Ortiz being revealed as TNA's big mystery man. Another one of those, you know, kind of LOL TNA moments when you look back on it. And AJ Styles and Austin Aries tear the house down on Impact. Now you can watch them do the same thing, just in a different promotion. And finally, episode 386 from June 7th, 2015, I gave my impassioned defense of John Cena from all of the hate that this man was getting at the time. I don't even remember what it was for. I'm pretty sure this came right after he put over Kevin Owens in Owens' first match on pay-per-view. But I felt compelled to defend Cena from all of the hate. I felt it was over the top. Also, Tyson Kidd suffers a spinal injury. And here we are almost 2 years later. He's still not back. And this is a historic episode of the Sound Off 386 is because it featured the very first buy or sell segment. The concept was a little different back then when it first started out. But the very first buy or sell was on Eva Marie. And I actually, well, I'll let you listen to it to see if I bought on Eva Marie or if I sold on her. But some good stuff to go back and check out this week in the archives. You can listen to past episodes of The Sound Off on thesolemonster.com. You can listen to them in iTunes. The very first 10 episodes I ever did are up on our YouTube channel. And there's a lot of hours of audio there for you to go back. And if you ever want to kill time, you ever want to laugh at some of the older shows I did, then be my guest. You can laugh at my expense. That's going to do it here. I am all tapped out. It's a long show, but still more enjoyable than Monday Night Raw. I think we can all agree. Episode 487 is on tap for next weekend. Don't forget, use our Audible link. You still have time to pre-order the AJ Lee book and get it for free using our Audible link, audibletrial.com/solemonster. If you don't want the AJ book, you still got The Death of WCW. You've got a whole bunch of different books on there for you to choose from. We will see you back here next weekend for more Sound Off. I'm sure there'll be a ton of news coming out of this Hardy stuff with TNA, and every week it just feels like something different. So I'll be here to cover it, as always, next weekend. I haven't missed a show in almost 7 years. I don't plan to start now. So until then, be well, stay safe. We'll see you back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster sounds off.
If WWE were a person, how would you describe them? It's just a very bizarre question. But these are the different options they gave as passionate, talented, funny, modest, except for all those did-you-know facts they pepper us with every single week. Kind, cheerful, sweet, surprising, adventurous, flexible. How the fuck can an organization be flexible? This is a real survey question here. You would think you were going on a date. I have no interest in dating WWE. They're clingy, they're painfully unfunny, and all they do is talk about themselves. They're not my type.
Solemonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solemonster sounds off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster sound off.